Wild Card 7, Dead Man's Hand, by George R. R. Martin and John Joseph Miller. Read for you by Jay Akavone and Adrian Paul. Monday, July 18th, 1988. 5 a.m. The trees were moving, though there was no wind. He did not know how long he had been walking, or how he had gotten to this place. But he was here, alone, and he was afraid. It was night, a night longer and darker than any he had ever known. Moonlight painted the landscape in shades of black and gray, but the moon was obscenely swollen, the color of rotting flesh. He looked up at it once, and for one awful moment it seemed to pulse. He knew he must not look again. Whatever he did, he must not look again. He walked. On and on he walked. The gray thin grass seemed to clutch at his bare feet with every step, to slide greasy tendrils between his toes. And the trees moved. Windless, they moved. Long, cruel branches, barren of any leaves, writhed and twisted as he passed, and whispered secrets he did not want to know. If he stopped for only a moment, he would hear them clearly. He would understand. And then surely he would go mad. He walked. Beneath that sickly sweet moonlight, things that did not bear thinking of woke and stirred. Vast leathery wings beat against the air, filling the night with the smell of corruption. Gaunt spider shapes, leprous and rotten, slipped between the trees just out of sight, their legs rustling softly as they moved. Never seen, but never far behind him. Once a long, low moan shuddered across the landscape, growing louder and louder until even the trees grew still and silent and afraid. And then, when the feeling of dread was so thick, he thought he might choke on it. He saw the subway kiosk up ahead. It stood in the middle of the forest, bathed in that awful moonlight. But he knew it belonged somehow. He began to run. He seemed to be moving very slowly, as if each stride took an eon. Slowly the mouth of the kiosk grew, the steps descending into the dark, the worn railing, the familiar signs. They called him home. Finally he reached the top of the stairs, just when he felt he could run no further. There were sounds behind him, but he dared not look around. He started down the steps, holding the handrail, faint with relief. It seemed as though he descended a long way. Trains rumbled through dark gulfs far, far below him. Still he descended. Now he could taste the fear again. The steps twisted around on themselves, spiraling down and down. Then well beneath him, he glimpsed another passenger. Descending, he moved faster, bare feet slapping against the cold stone, down and around, and saw him again, a big man in a heavy black coat. He tried to call out to him, but here, in this place, his voice was gone. He ran even faster. He ran until his feet began to bleed. The steps had grown very narrow. They opened suddenly, and he stepped out onto a long, narrow platform suspended over a vast blackness, a darkness that swallowed all light. The other man stood on the platform. There was something odd about his proportions, something disturbing about the way he stood there, humped and silent. Then he turned, and Jay saw its face, a featureless white cone that tapered to a single wet red tentacle. It lifted its head and began to howl. Jay screamed and woke, shaking in a dark room that smelled of piss. "God damn," he muttered. His heart sounded like a rock drummer on speed. His underwear was soaked with sweat, and he'd wet the bed. This had been a bad one. Jay fumbled for the bedside lamp and swung his legs off the side of the bed and sat waiting for the nightmare to recede. It seemed so real. But it always did. He'd been having the same damn nightmare since he was a kid, when he'd started waking up screaming twice a week. His parents banned H.P. Lovecraft from the bookshelf, and threw away his prized collection of EC comics. It didn't help. The dream stayed with him. Sometimes it went away for months. Then, just when he thought he was rid of it forever, it would return with a fury and haunt his sleep night after night. He would be 45 this year, and the dream was as vivid as the first time he had dreamt it. It was always the same, the long walk through that nightmarish forest, the old New York City subway kiosk, the endless descent into the earth, and finally the cone-faced thing on the platform. Sometimes just after he woke, Jay thought that there was more to the dream, that there were parts he was forgetting. But if that was true, he didn't want to know. Jay Aykroyd made his living as a private detective. He had a healthy respect for fear that had saved his life a time or two, but he didn't scare easily. At least, not when he was awake. But he had one secret terror, that some night he would find himself standing on that platform, and the cone-faced thing would turn and lift its head and howl, and he wouldn't wake up. "No fucking thanks," Jay said aloud. He looked at the clock, a few minutes past 5 in the morning. No sense trying to get back to sleep. He was due at the Crystal Palace in less than 2 hours. Besides, after one of his dreams, nothing short of cardiac arrest would close his eyes again. Jay stripped his bed, bundling sheets, blankets, and underwear in his hamper to take to the laundromat the next chance he got. He'd be sleeping on Crystal Palace sheets for the next week or two, however long this gig with Chrysalis lasted. He hoped like hell the nightmare went away for a little while. He didn't think Chrysalis would be too thrilled to learn her new bodyguard had a recurring nightmare that freaked him out so bad that he wet his bed, especially if she was in the bed when he wet it. Jay had been hitting on Chrysalis for years, but she'd never succumbed to his charms. He was hoping this might be his chance. Her body was so alive. Beneath that translucent skin, you could see the blood rushing through her veins, the ghostly movement of half-seen muscles, the way her lungs worked under the bones of a ribcage. And she had great tits, even if they were mostly invisible. He opened up his window to air out his bedroom, although the odors wafting up the dingy air shaft to his third-floor walk-up were almost as foul as those in the room. After a long soak in his clawfoot tub, he dried himself off in a beach towel decorated with a rather threadbare picture of Opus the Penguin. In the top drawer of his dresser, Jay found some clean boxer shorts, black socks in the drawer below. Then he went to the closet and looked at his suits. He had a cool white linen number that was fashionably rumpled, a charcoal gray Brooks Brothers three-piece, a pinstripe from Hong Kong that had been precisely tailored to his measurements. Hiram Worcester had given him all three. Hiram was always after Jay to dress better. He'd get more respect, Hiram promised. He'd get noticed. He might even get girls. The part about the girls tempted him, but otherwise, Jay was having none of it. "Hiram," he had explained, "I'm a PI. I sit and park cars in donut shops. I shoot Polaroids through motel windows. I bribe doormen and hide in bushes. I don't want to be noticed. If they made a suit out of Holiday Inn wallpaper, I'd buy 6 of them." But every Christmas, Hiram gave him another goddamned suit. It looked like it was going to be hot. Jay picked out a short-sleeve white shirt with a button-down collar, a pair of dark brown slacks to match his hair, and a tan blazer. No tie. He hated ties.
7 a.m. Brennan woke from a deep, dreamless sleep as the light from the rising sun shone through the window and touched his face. Jennifer Malloy turned over, murmuring, as he slipped silently from under the sheet that covered their futon and padded noiselessly to the chair where his clothes were laid out. He put on shorts, t-shirt, and running shoes, and went quietly through the back door that opened to the outside. The sun was up, the land was half awake, wet with dew and alive with the smells of a clean country morning. Brennan took a deep breath, filling his lungs with fresh air as he stretched, unlimbering his body for his daily run. He jogged to the front of the A-frame house, slipping into a slow trot as he reached the looping gravel driveway. He turned left at the mouth of the driveway, scattering the rabbits playing on the front lawn, and passed the sign that read, Archer Landscaping and Nursery. He felt alive and clean, at peace with himself and the world at the beginning of another beautiful day.
After his third knock went unanswered, Jay stepped inside the Crystal Palace. The door wasn't locked. That surprised him. Chrysalis had been expecting him, yes, but she'd also been expecting trouble. Otherwise, why bother to hire a bodyguard? When you're expecting trouble, you're supposed to lock your doors. Jay poked his head into the darkened tap room. Anyone home? He called softly. Chrysalis! Elmo? There was no answer. Real good, he muttered under his breath. No wonder she needed a bodyguard. He considered turning on the lights, thought better of it, waited for his eyes to adjust. Slowly, the outlines of the familiar room began to emerge from the gloom. Straight-back chairs upended on small round tables. The bar along one wall, rows of bottles stacked behind it, against a long silver mirror. Booths across the way, and way in back, set off a little from the rest. The antique table in the private alcove where Chrysalis herself held court and sipped her amaretto. For a moment in the morning half-light, Jay thought he saw her sitting there, cloaked in shadow, slim ivory cigarette holder held lightly between skeletal fingers, smoke coiling lazily through the clear flesh of her throat as she tossed back her head to smile. Chrysalis? He said, walking slowly across the tap room, but her chair was empty when he reached it. A strange chill went through him. That was the moment when Jay Aykroyd knew. He stood quietly beside the table, listening, remembering what he knew of the Crystal Palace. Chrysalis lived on the third floor, her chambers crowded with expensive Victoriana. Elmo, her dwarf bouncer, lived on the second floor, so did Sasha, the eyeless telepath who tended bar for her. All the public rooms were on the first floor, so was her office. Jay decided to start there. The office was in the back of the building, under the stairs. It had a wooden door, ornately carved, with a crystal doorknob. Jay took a rumpled handkerchief out of his pocket and turned the knob carefully. With two fingers, the door swung open. The room was windowless and black, but Jay didn't need eyes to know what he'd find inside. Death has a smell all its own. The hard coppery scent of blood. The sweaty stench of fear. The stink of shit. He'd smelled it before. The familiar miasma was there, waiting for him, and under it all was her perfume. God damn you, Jay said quietly, to no one in particular. He reached over, handkerchief still in hand, and found the light switch. Once this room had had charm. Polished hardwood floors, a gorgeous oriental rug, floor-to-ceiling bookcases full of leather-bound first editions, a solid oak desk, older than he was. Big leather armchairs that looked as though they might have come from the world's oldest men's club. The chairs were shattered, wooden legs cracked and splintered, soft leather upholstery ripped and torn. Three of the high wooden bookcases had been toppled. One had been snapped in two. Splinters, as long and pale as knives, sprang from where the two halves clung together. Books were scattered everywhere. Chrysalis lay sprawled on her back across the shattered remains of an armchair, the leather cushions and broken legs a jumble beneath her. The huge oak desk had been tipped over across the upper part of her body, hiding her face. She'd been wearing blue jeans and a plain white blouse. The front of the blouse was spattered with tiny droplets of blood. Her left leg bent the wrong way at the knee, and a jagged red piece of shin bone poked through the denim. Jay squatted by her left hand. He could see her finger bones through the ghostly outlines of tendons and the smooth, clear skin. All five fingers were shattered, the ring finger in two places. Her crystalline flesh was suffused with the rosy glow of burst capillaries. Jay took her broken fingers in his own. A faint warmth still clung to her body. But she was cooling even as he held her. After a moment, he released her hand and tried to lift the desk off her. It was heavy. He grimaced, shoved harder, and righted it with a grunt. Only when the desk was back against the wall did he look back down at Chrysalis. Her face was gone. Her skull hadn't been crushed, as much as it had been obliterated. The back cushion of her chair was sticky with dried blood. Bits of mashed brain oozed out between fragments of bone. Everything was red and wet. A small pool of blood had gathered under what was left of the chair, soaking into the oriental rug. Jay looked up and saw more blood, a faint spray of it across the front of the desk and low on the walls around the light socket. The patterned antique wallpaper was a gloomy purple color, very Victorian. It was hard to see the blood spatters, but they were there when you looked. Jay stood up and tried not to feel anything. He'd seen bodies before, more than he cared to think about, and Chrysalis had been playing dangerous games for a long, long time. She knew too many secrets. Sooner or later, something like this was bound to happen. He studied the position of the body, committing it to memory. It wasn't Chrysalis now, just dead meat, just evidence. When he'd seen all there was to see, Jay turned his attention to the rest of the room. That was when he first noticed the small rectangle of cardboard lying beside her left thigh. He moved around her and squatted for a closer look. He didn't touch it. He didn't have to. There wasn't a drop of blood on it, and it was lying face up. A playing card. The Ace of Spades. "Son of a bitch," he said. He was closing the office door behind him when he heard footsteps on the stairs. Jay pressed himself against the wall and waited. A moment later, a slender man with a pencil-thin mustache stepped into the hall. He wore slippers and a silk dressing gown, and there was an unbroken expanse of pale skin where his eyes should have been. His head turned slowly until he was looking into the shadows at Jay.
"I can see your mind, Poppin' Jay," he said.
Jay stepped out. "Call the police, Sasha," he said. "And don't call me Poppin' Jay, damn it."
8 a.m. Brennan leaned into the hill, arms pumping, breath flowing easily, sprinting up the steep grade near the end of the run that had taken him over the forested hills and through dew-drenched meadows. The route he followed varied, but always ended at the unpaved county road that led him, sweaty and pleasantly winded, back to the gravel driveway with Archer Landscaping and Nursery posted at the entrance. The driveway looped around a series of gardens that were living advertisements of his horticultural skills. First was a Japanese miniature hill garden in the Tsukiyama form, then an English shrubbery, and third, a traditional flower bed blooming with a dozen different species of a dozen different hues. The driveway circled the flower bed and led past two greenhouses, one for tropical foliage, the other for desert species, and the A-frame house. Brennan finished his run with a gut-bursting sprint that brought him around behind the A-frame. He took a few minutes to cool down and calm his breathing, then folded himself comfortably into a meditative posture and gazed out over the Kari Sansui, the raked gravel bed rippling like frozen water in the morning breeze. Nested in the gravel were three rock triads. Brennan spent a timeless time sunk in the pool of Zazen, not studying the rocks, their shadows, or the patterns of the moss that grew on them, then stood smoothly, relaxed, refreshed, and ready for the day. He went back into the bedroom that was sparsely furnished with a futon on the polished wood floor, a comfortable chair with reading lamp and side table stacked with books, and a large wicker clothes hamper. Jennifer had gotten out of bed. He could hear water running in the shower of the connecting bathroom. Brennan took off his sweat-soaked T-shirt and dropped it in the hamper as he passed on through to the room that served as a combination living room office. He flicked on the television to get the morning news, then sat at his desk and fired up the PC to check his schedule. He watched the television as the computer tracked down the proper file. Most of the news was devoted to the Democratic National Convention, convening today in Atlanta, nothing of substance had happened yet, but the analysis and predictions already seemed overblown and overdone. Greg Hardman was the favorite, but his nomination would be a struggle, particularly with the man directly opposite him in political philosophy and belief, the Reverend Leo Barnett. Brennan distrusted all politicians, but if he could vote, he would cast his ballot for Hardman. The man seemed honest and caring, especially when compared with the demagogue Barnett. A lot of jokers were backing Hardman. The news cameras panned the Atlanta public parks, where they had gathered by the thousands to noisily show the nation their depth of support for the senator. Brennan watched a few interviews with the joker on the street, then turned down the volume on the television set and turned his attention to the computer screen. He wished Hardman and his joker support as well, but the day was already getting old, and he had his own worries. His schedule had come up on the screen, and it promised to be a full day. Archer Landscaping was in the middle of two jobs. Brennan was building a hill garden with a sutaiochi, a miniature waterfall trickling over a bed of in-placed rocks, for a Japanese-American banker who had just moved into the area, and he was also constructing a multi-terrace shrubbery with a fish pond for a doctor who lived down the road. Joaquim Ortiz, Brennan's foreman, would boss the crew at the doctor's while he took care of the other job. Japanese gardens were his personal specialty. Brennan leaned back in the chair, still mildly surprised at the contentment he felt as he contemplated the upcoming day. Abandoning death and destruction and returning to the country to nurture life was the best thing he had ever done. He felt cleansed, content, and at peace for the first time in years. Sometimes he felt guilty for setting aside his vendetta against Kien and the Shadow Fist Society, but over the last few months, the guilt had been coming less frequently and with less intensity. He took his copy of Sakuteki, Tashibana Toshitsune's classic treatise on garden design, from his reference shelf, but before he could look through it to get some ideas for the new job, he stopped to stare at the image of a well-remembered woman that filled the television screen. He turned up the volume.
Mysterious woman known only as Chrysalis was found dead this morning in the office of her nightclub, the Crystal Palace. The police have so far refused comment, but an ace of spades found on her body has linked the slaying to the mysterious bow and arrow vigilante known as Yeoman, who was responsible for at least 50 deaths in 1986 and early 1987.
Brennan was still staring at the screen as Jennifer Malloy walked through the wall, damp from her shower, carrying two cups of tea.
"What's the matter?" she asked when she saw the expression on his face. "What happened?"
Brennan turned to her, the coldness back in his eyes, the hardness back on his face.
"Chrysalis is dead."
"Dead?"
she echoed unbelievingly.
"Murdered."
"How? By who?"
Jennifer asked as she sank down into the chair facing him. She handed him one of the cups. He took it mechanically and put it aside.
"Report didn't say, but her killer tried to frame me by putting an ace of spades on the body."
"Frame you? Why?"
Brennan looked at her for the first time.
"I don't know, but I'm going to find out."
"The police?"
"The police think I did it."
"That's insane," Jennifer said. "We haven't been to the city for over a year."
They'd been so busy that it hadn't seemed that long since Brennan had called off his vendetta against the Shadow Fist crime lord named Kien and left New York City with Jennifer. They'd spent some time traveling, some time resting and healing and learning to love one another, then settled down outside of Goshen, a small town just north of New York City. Jennifer began writing what she hoped would become the definitive biography of Robert Tomlin. Brennan, weary of dealing in death, wanting to build rather than destroy, had started a landscaping business. He found that he had a genuine talent for horticulture, and Jennifer was happy researching and writing her book. They'd been quite content with their quiet, peaceful, isolated existence.
"Someone set me up," Brennan said in a low voice.
"Who?"
He looked at Jennifer.
"Kien."
She leaned back, considering it.
"Why?"
Brennan shrugged.
"Maybe he found out that Chrysalis knew he was the head of the Shadow Fists. Maybe he thought that he could get rid of her and me at the same time."
"The police would never find you if we stay here."
"Maybe," Brennan conceded. "But maybe they'll never find Chrysalis's real killer either."
"We're building something here," Jennifer said. "We can't just let it go."
"Let it go. It should be easy," Brennan told himself.
to let the past go, to live for the present and the future. But he couldn't. Someone had murdered his ex-lover. He couldn't forget that. And then the murderer had framed him for it. He couldn't forgive that. He stood up. I'm not letting anything go. I can. Jennifer just looked at him. After a moment, he turned and went out to the back and unlocked the shed where he kept his bows and guns. He loaded the van and sat waiting in it for several minutes, wondering if Jennifer was going to join him. After a while, he started the engine and drove away, alone.
Noon. Bezerek played the good cop. Kant played the bad cop, and both of them deserved rave reviews. Jay Aykroyd had seen the act before, though. Mazurek was lean and dark, with intense violet eyes. Kant was a hairless, scaled joker with nictitating membranes and pointed teeth. As Jay ran through his story for the seventh time, he found himself wondering whether they swapped roles when the suspect was a joker. He took one look at Kant and decided not to ask. By lunchtime, even the two detectives had gotten tired of going round the mulberry bush.
"If you're playing games with us, you're going to be real sorry," Kant said, showing his incisors.
Jay gave him a, "Who, me?" look. "I'm sure Mr. Aykroyd's told us everything he knows, Harv," Mazurek said. "If you do happen to remember anything else that might be of use, you'll give us a call." Mazurek gave him his card. Kant told him not to leave town, and they walked him to the squad room to sign a copy of his statement. The precinct house was full of familiar faces. The doorman from the Crystal Palace was giving a statement to a uniformed cop, while a waitress that Chrysalis had fired last month sobbed loudly in the corner. Other palace employees waited on long wooden benches by the window. He recognized three waiters, a dishwasher, and the guy who played ragtime piano in the green room on Thursday nights. But the most important faces were the ones he didn't see. Lupo, the relief bartender, sat alone by an unoccupied desk. After he dealt with the paperwork, Jay drifted over.
"Can you believe it?" the joker asked. "What's going to happen to us?"
Lupo had deep-set red eyes and a wolf's face. He'd been shedding. There were hairs all over the shoulders of his denim shirt. Jay brushed them off. Lupo hardly seemed to notice.
"I hear it was you that found the body," he said. "Was it really the Ace of Spades guy?"
"There was a card next to the body," Jay said.
"Yeoman," Lupo muttered angrily. "Son of a bitch. I thought he was gone for good. He used to drink Tullamore Dew. I served him once or twice."
"Ever see him without the mask?" Lupo shook his head.
"Now, I hope they catch the fucker."
His long red tongue lolled from a corner of his mouth. Jay looked around the room again.
"Where's Elmo?" "No one's seen him. I heard the cops got a, what you call it, APB out on him."
Kant came up behind them.
"Your turn, Lupo," he said, gesturing toward an interrogation room. He stared at Jay. "You still here?"
I'm going, Jay said. "As soon as I use the little cop's room." Kant told him where to find it. By the time Jay emerged, Kant and Mazurek and Lupo were off doing their thing. Jay went back to the captain's cubicle and walked in unannounced. Captain Angela Ellis was behind the desk, chain-smoking, as she scanned a file, flipping pages like a speed reader. She was a tiny Asian woman with green eyes, long black hair, and the toughest job in the NYPD. Her immediate predecessor had been found dead in this office, supposedly of a heart attack, but there were still people who didn't buy that. The captain before him had been murdered, too.
"So," he asked, "you have a lead on Elmo yet?"
Ellis took a drag on her cigarette and looked at him. It took her a moment to remember who he was.
"Aykroyd," she finally said with distaste. "I was just reading your statement. There are holes in your story I could drive a truck through."
"I can't help that. It's the only story I got." "What kind of story did you get from Sasha?"
"A short one," Ellis stood and began to pace. "He woke up, sensed the strange mind in the building, and came downstairs to find you sneaking out of Chrysalis's office."
"I didn't sneak," Jay said.
I sneak very well. I majored in sneaking in detective school, but on this particular occasion, I didn't happen to be sneaking, and there's nothing strange about my mind, thank you. So you don't have a thing on Elmo yet. What do you know about Elmo? Ellis asked. Short guy, Jay said. Strong guy, Ellis mused. Strong enough to smash a woman's head into blood pudding, maybe? Real good, Jay said. Only wrong. Elmo was devoted to the lady, utterly. No way he'd hurt her. Her laugh was hard and humorless. Aykroyd, you may be the world's chief authority on philandering husbands, but you don't know much about killers. They don't waste the real atrocities on strangers. They save them for family and friends. She started to pace again. Ash fell off the end of her cigarette. Maybe your friend Elmo was a little too devoted. I heard Chrysalis fucked around a lot. Maybe he got tired of seeing the parade go in and out of her bedroom. Or maybe he made a pass of his own. And she laughed at him. You setting up Elmo to take the fall? He asked. Ellis paused over her desk, just long enough to stub out her cigarette in an ashtray overflowing with butts. No one gets set up in this precinct. Since when? Jay asked. Since I took over as captain, she told him. She took a pack of Camels out of her jacket, tapped one out, lit up, and resumed pacing. You're supposed to be a detective. Look at the facts. She stopped at the wall long enough to straighten the framed diploma, then spun back toward him. Her head looked like a cantaloupe run over by a semi. Both legs broken, every finger in her left hand snapped, her pelvis shattered in 6 places, massive internal hemorrhaging. She jabbed a cigarette at him for emphasis. I had a case once, back when I was on the street, where some Gambioni capos went to work on a guy with tire irons, broke every bone in his body. Another time, I saw what was left of a hooker who'd been done in by a pimp fried on angel dust. He used a baseball bat. Those were pretty ugly, but they looked a lot better than Chrysalis. Those weren't normal blows. Nobody's that strong. Nobody but an ace or a joker with superhuman strength. A lot of people fit that description, Jay pointed out. Only one of them lived in the Crystal Palace, Ellis pointed out. She crossed behind the desk, sat down, opened a file folder. Elmo was strong enough. Maybe, Jay said. Elmo was way stronger than a gnat. That was true enough. But there were others who made him look like a 97-pound weakling. The Harlem Hammer, Troll, Carnifex, The Oddity, even that golden asshole, Jack Braun. Whether Elmo actually had the raw power to do what had been done to Chrysalis was a question Jay didn't have the expertise to answer. Captain Ellis ignored his quibbling. He also had the opportunity. Anytime he wanted. She began rearranging a stack of files in her outbasket, dropping ash on them in the process. I don't buy it, Jay said. If Elmo is so goddamned innocent, where is he? Ellis asked, toying with her stapler. We searched his room. The bed hadn't been slept in. He hasn't returned to the palace. Where'd he go? Jay shrugged. Out. She had him there, but he was damned if he was going to admit it. Seems to me you got another candidate who's a lot riper than Elmo. Captain Angela Ellis slammed down the stapler and blew a long plume of smoke across the room. Ah, right. The Ace of Spades killer. She didn't sound impressed. We're going to find Elmo, she promised, crushing out her cigarette. And when we do, 5'll get you 10, it turns out your dwarf pal dropped that card. You can buy a deck of playing cards at any 5 and 10. You're supposed to be a bright boy, Aykroyd. Figure it out for yourself.
Maybe I will, Jay said. Angela Ellis didn't like that one bit. Her bright green eyes narrowed as she stood up.
Let me make one thing real clear. I don't like PIs, and I don't like aces. So you can probably guess how I feel about ace PIs. You start getting in the way on this one, you can kiss your license goodbye.
You're beautiful when you're angry,
Jay said. Ellis ignored him. I don't like bodies cluttering up my precinct either.
You must be unhappy a lot of the time, Jay said as he headed for the door. He paused in the doorway to study her little glass-walled cubicle.
Is really where they killed Captain Black? He asked innocently. Yes, she snapped, irritated.
Jay figured he'd hit a sore point. Knowing the NYPD, they probably hadn't even gotten her a new chair.
What the hell are you doing? She said.
Getting a good picture of the place in my head, Jay said. He smiled crookedly and made his right hand into a gun. Three fingers folded down, thumb cocked like a hammer. Index finger pointed at Angela Ellis. I'm a good boy, Captain. If I bump into your killer, I want to send him right here to you.
She looked puzzled for a moment, then flushed when she remembered what he could do. Aces, she muttered. Get the hell out of here.
He did. Kent and Mazurek were back in the squad room.
Captain on the reg? Jay asked as he passed.
They exchanged looks and watched him leave. Jay went out the front door, walked around the block, went back in, and took the steps down to the basement. The precinct records were kept in a dimly lit, low-ceilinged room next to the boiler, part of which had been the coal cellar once upon a time. Now it held a couple of computer consoles, a Xerox machine, a wall of overflowing steel filing cabinets, and one very pale, very short, very nearsighted policeman.
Hello, Joe, Jay said.
Jomo turned around and sniffed at the stale air. He was just under 5 feet tall, stooped and pot-bellied, with a complexion the color of a mushroom. Tiny pink eyes peered out from behind the largest, thickest pair of tinted spectacles that Jay had ever seen. White, hairless hands rubbed together nervously. Mo had been the first joker on the NYPD, and for more than a decade, he'd been the only joker on the NYPD. His appointment forced through under the banner of affirmative action during Mayor Hartman's administration in the early 70s had drawn so much fire that the department had promptly hidden him down in records to keep him out of public view. Joe hadn't minded. He liked records, almost as much as he liked basements. They called him Sergeant Mole.
Poppin' Jay, Mo said.
He adjusted his glasses. The milk white of his skin was shocking against the dark blue of his uniform. And he always wore his cap, night and day, even indoors.
Is it true?
Yeah, it's true, Jay told him. Mo had been a pariah when he joined the force, even in Fort Freak. No one had wanted to partner him, and he'd been made unwelcome in the usual cop bars. He'd been doing his off-duty drinking in the Crystal Palace since its doors first opened, paying for every drink in a rather ostentatious show of rectitude, and collecting 10 times his tab under the table for acting as Chrysalis's eyes and ears in the cop house.
I heard you were the one found the body, Jomo said. Nasty business, wasn't it? Makes you wonder what Joker Town is coming to. You'd think she'd be safe, if anyone was.
He blinked behind the dark, thick lenses.
What can I do for you, dear boy?
I need to see the file on the Ace of Spades killer.
Yeoman, Jomo said.
Yeoman, Jay Ackroyd repeated thoughtfully. It came back to him then.
Yeoman, I don't care for this, Chrysalis had said, with ice in her voice, that night a year and a half ago when they'd faced off in the darkened tap room of the palace. She was always a master of understatement. I remember, he said. Why, there hasn't been a new bow and arrow killing in more than a year, Mo said. You really think he's the one?
I hope not, Jay said. Yeoman had entered the tap room, silent as smoke, and before anyone even noticed him, he'd had a hunting arrow notched and ready, but Hiram Worcester had stepped in the way in righteous indignation. And Jay had gotten the drop on the guy. Suddenly, Yeoman was gone in a pop of inrushing air. Jay Ackroyd was a projecting teleport. When his right hand made a gun, he could pop his targets any place he knew well enough to visualize.
Only he'd sent that fucker Yeoman to the wrong damn place. I had the son of a bitch dead to rights, Joe, he said. I could have popped him right into the tombs. Instead, I sent him to the middle of the Holland Tunnel. God knows why. Something about his tone when he'd replied to Chrysalis, maybe, or the loathing in his eyes when he glanced toward Worm, or maybe the fact that he'd had the decency to hesitate when Hiram stepped forward and blocked his shot. Or it could have been the girl he had with him, the masked blonde in the string bikini who seemed so fresh and innocent. It hadn't been what you call a deliberate conscious decision. A lot of the time, Jay just went on gut instinct. But if he'd been wrong that night, then Chrysalis had paid for it with her life. I really need to see that file, he said. Joe Moe made a sad little clucking sound. Why, that file's up on the captain's desk, Jay. She sent down for it right away, soon as the squeal came in. Of course, I made a Xerox before I sent it up. It always pays to make a Xerox. Sometimes things get misplaced, and you don't want to lose any valuable documents. He blinked slowly, looked around. Now, where did I put that? It's a wonder I ever find anything with my eyes.
The copies were on top of the Xerox machine. Jay riffled through the folder, rolled up the papers, and slid them under his blazer. Replaced them with 220s. I'm sure you'll sniff them out, he said.
If not, Joe said, with a wide pink smile, I can always wait till the captain returns the originals and Xerox another set.
He busied himself with some filing. But when Jay opened the door to leave, he called out quietly,
Pop and Jay.
Jay looked back.
What? Find the bastard, Jomo said.
He took off his tinted specs, and his pale pink eyes implored.
All of us will help, he promised.
And Jay knew he wasn't talking about the police.
As he drove down Route 17, alone, Brennan was already missing Jennifer. He couldn't blame her for not accompanying him on a quest to find Chrysalis's murderer. And it didn't help any that she'd been right. They had a quiet, beautiful life. Why was he so ready to return to the death waiting him in the city? It wasn't, Brennan knew, because he enjoyed the killing and the violence. He'd rather build a garden than dodge bullets in a stinking, garbage-choked alley. It all came down to what Jennifer had said about letting things go. He just couldn't get Chrysalis out of his mind. He didn't think of her often. He was too satisfied with his life with Jennifer to dwell morbidly on what might have been with another woman. But sometimes at night, he'd lie awake with Jennifer asleep beside him and remember the Crystal Lady. He'd remember her invisible flesh, flushed to a delicate pink with a passion of their lovemaking. He'd remember her cries and moves in the dark. He'd remember and wonder what it would have been like if she'd accepted his offer of protection and love. He would look at Jennifer asleep at his side and know that he was happy and content, but he would still wonder. The memory of her was a throbbing ache that wouldn't leave him alone. He buried the van in Tomlin International parking lot and caught a taxi to Manhattan, where he took a room in a cheap but dirty hotel on the fringe of Jokertown. The first thing to do, he decided, was visit the Crystal Palace. He slipped on his mask for the first time in over a year and left the hotel carrying his bow case.
3 p.m. Ace of Spades killer slays Jokertown barkeep, the Post screamed. The Jokertown cry was less generic. Chrysalis murdered, it said beside a two-column picture. The Cry was the only paper in the city that regularly ran photographs of jokers. Jokers descend on Atlanta as Democrats convene, said the front page of the Times. Thousands of them had headed south in support of Senator Greg Hartman, the presidential frontrunner. But in this year's crowded Democratic field, nobody was even close to a majority, and a brokered convention was being predicted. There were widespread fears of violence should Hartman be denied the nomination. Already there were reports of ugly clashes between Hartman's jokers and the fundamentalist supporters of Reverend Leo Barnett. Jay usually ranked politicians right alongside used car salesmen, pimps, and the guy who invented pay toilets. But Hartman did seem to be a breed apart. He'd met the candidate a few times at the fundraisers Hiram had hosted at Aces High. Hiram was a big Hartman supporter, and Jay never could resist the lure of free food and drink. Senator Gregg seemed intelligent, effective, and compassionate. If somebody had to be president, it might as well be him. He probably didn't stand a joker's chance of getting anywhere near the nomination. The political bullshit took up the whole front page. He couldn't find any mention of Chrysalis anywhere. Knowing the times, Jay figured tomorrow's edition would have a brief obit and that'd be it. Brutal joker murders weren't the kind of news that's fit to print. That made Jay angriest of all.
How do you know when a joker's been dead about 3 days?
The news vendor asked him. His voice was flat and lifeless. The voice of a man grimly going through a ritual that had lost its meaning. Jay looked up from the headlines. Jube Benson had been a fixture on the corners of Hester Street and the Bowery for as long as there had been a joker town. Walrus, they called him. He was a joker himself, 300 pounds of greasy blue-black flesh, big curved tusks at the corners of his mouth, a broad domed skull covered with tufts of stiff red hair. Jube's wardrobe seemed to consist exclusively of Hawaiian shirts. This afternoon, he was wearing a magenta item in a tasteful pineapple and banana print. Jay wondered what Hiram would say. Jube knew more Joker jokes than anyone else in Jokertown, but this time, Jay had the punchline. He smells a lot better, he said wearily. That one's older than your hat, Walrus. Jube took the battered pork pie hat off his head and turned it over self-consciously in his thick three-fingered hands.
I never made her laugh, he said. All those years, I came by the palace every night, always with a new joke. I never got a single laugh out of her.
She didn't think being a joker was very funny, said Jay.
You gotta laugh, Jube said. What else is there?
He put his hat back on.
I hear you were the one that found her.
Word gets around quick, Jay said.
It gets around quick, Jube agreed.
She phoned me last night, Jay told him. She wanted to take me on as a bodyguard. I asked her how long, but she couldn't tell me. Maybe she wouldn't tell me. I asked her what she was scared of. She laughed it off and said I'd found her out. It was just a ruse. She was really hot from my body. That was when I realized how shaky she was. She was trying her damnedest to sound wry and cool and British, like nothing was wrong. But her accent kept slipping. Something had frightened her badly. I want to know what, Jube.
All I know is what I read in the papers, Jube said.
Jay just gave him a look. As long as Chrysalis had been brokering information, the Walrus had been one of her chief snitches. All day long, Jube stood in his kiosk, watching and listening, joking and gossiping with everyone who stopped to buy a paper. Come on, Jay said impatiently. Jube glanced nervously up and down the street. No one was near them.
Not here,
the fat joker said.
Let me close up. We'll go to my place.
Brennan watched with wry amusement as the armless joker pickpocket worked the gawkers who had gathered around the Crystal Palace. The Dipper was dressed in threadbare but carefully patched clothes. His pants were specially tailored to fit his third, sentry-located leg that ended in an oddly configured foot whose toes were more dexterous than most people's fingers. He was using this limb to pick the pockets of his unsuspecting victims. A bright yellow crime scene ribbon roped off the palace's canopied entrance. The crowd gathered before it was gossiping, mostly wildly and inaccurately, about the Crystal Palace and its mysterious proprietress. Newsies and street merchants were working the crowd, along with a pickpocket who suddenly turned with a sixth sense of the often hunted and looked right at Brennan. Brennan nodded back, and the three-legged joker cut through the crowd and headed toward him, lurching in a peculiar rocking gait, sometimes placing his third foot on the ground to balance himself.
Hello, Mr. Y, he murmured.
Brennan nodded again. The joker's name was Tripod. He was a hustler, a small-time grifter who lived on the edge of the law. During Brennan's last stay in the city, he'd been one of his best sources of information. He was dependable for a snitch. He didn't have a drug habit, and he was loyal. When he was bought, he stayed bought.
Pretty awful what happened, Mr. Y,
he offered in his quiet,
deferential manner. If he wondered about Brennan's sudden reappearance after a year's absence, he said nothing.
Brennan nodded. You hear the police think I killed her?
Tripart shrugged. It was a peculiar gesture for a man who had no arms.
Maybe, Mr. Y, but it wasn't done in your style.
How do you know how she was killed?
Man over there,
Tripod said, gesturing at a derelict who sat on the curb by a hot dog cart.
Said he saw her body when they brung her out to the coroner's wagon.
Brennan glanced at the cart. Sauerkraut Sam, the hot dog man, was lettered on its side. It was manned by a joker who was continuously dispensing dogs, making change, and slapping mustard, catsup, sauerkraut, and relish on waiting buns with his extra sets of arms. The derelict sitting on the curb was bloated and alcoholic, but seemed to be a gnat. He stationed himself next to the cart to catch coins while endlessly repeating his story to all who would listen. Brennan nodded at Tripod, and they joined the gawkers, who were munching hot dogs and listening to the old man.
I was in the back when they brung her out. I was there all right. I got a nice place to sleep right by the dumpster, and the ambulance woke me up. I was scared. I didn't know what all the fuss was about, but pretty soon they brung her out. I could see it was Chrysalis. I seen her a lot of times, and it was her. She was dead all right.
He lowered his voice and leaned forward to whisper conspiratorially to his 24 or so listeners.
Her head was squashed. Just squashed. If it weren't for her invisible skin, you couldn't tell who it was. Squashed just like a watermelon drop from a 10-story building.
He nodded with some satisfaction at his simile.
I was there all right. I saw her when they brung her out.
Brennan, impotent anger knotting his stomach, turned away from the cart as a cop came up and hassled the vendor about his license. Sauerkraut Sam complained in a loud voice with angry gesticulations of all his arms, but it didn't seem to get him anywhere. Brennan and Tripod stood silently for a moment, watching the cop run off the hot dog vendor, who was wheeling his cart with four arms and still angrily gesturing with the others. Chrysalis had been killed by someone, an ace, strong enough to smash her utterly. That was at least a place to start an investigation. But Brennan knew he could use more information, a lot more information.
You seen Elmo or Sasha around? Brennan asked Tripod, after the crowd that had been munching hot dogs and listening to the derelict had dispersed. The Joker shook his head.
They're gone, Mr. Y. Ain't seen them, ain't heard of them all day.
Brennan sighed to himself. He knew right away that this was not going to be easy. He took 20s out of his pocket and surreptitiously dropped them on the sidewalk. Tripod's bare foot closed over them. His nimble toes picked them up and stuffed them in one of the pockets he'd sewn on the bottom of his pant leg.
Keep an eye out for him. For anything about the killing, you can get in touch with me at the Victoria. I'm registered as Archer.
Yes, sir.
Tripod watched Brennan for a moment.
Good to see you again, Mr. Y.
Wish I could say it was good to be back.
Tripod nodded once and started down the street with his peculiar lurching gait. Brennan watched him go, then turned back to the palace. The crowd of gawkers was still there. He wanted to get a good look at the crime scene, but now, obviously, wasn't the time for that. He'd come back when it was quiet and dark. Now he had other avenues to explore. He wasn't convinced that Kian was actually behind Chrysalis's death, but it was as good a place as any to start his investigation. Kian, of course, wouldn't have done the killing himself, but the Shadow Fist had plenty of hired muscle capable of doing the job. Worm, for example, Kien's extraordinarily strong bodyguard, whom Brennan had witnessed threaten Chrysalis 2 wild card days ago. Of course, he'd been out of touch a long time. Things had probably changed, but there were people he could talk to, people who would be willing to pass on the latest information. Brennan hefted his bow case and started down the street. The hunter had returned to the city.
4 p.m. Jube lived in the basement of a rooming house on Eldridge, in an apartment with bare brick walls and a lingering odor of rotting meat. His living room featured a lot of second-hand furniture and some kind of weird modern sculpture, an imposing floor-to-ceiling construct with angles out of Escher, and a bowling ball at its center,
Every now and then, the bowling ball seemed to glow.
I call it Joker lust, Jupe told him. You think that's strange looking? You ought to meet the girl who modeled for it. Don't look too long. It'll give you a headache. Want a drink?
St. Elmo's fire flickered disturbingly across the surface of the construct. Jay sat down on the edge of the couch. I'll take a scotch and soda, he said. Go easy on the soda.
All I have is rum,
Jupe said, waddling into his kitchen. Yum, Jay said deadpan. Sure. Jupe brought him a water tumbler, half full of dark rum, with a single ice cube floating on the surface.
The papers say it was the Ace of Spades killer,
he said as he eased his bulk into a recliner, his own glass of rum in hand. His was decorated with a little paper parasol.
The Post and the Cry both.
There was an Ace of Spades next to the body, Jay agreed, sipping his drink. The cops don't buy it.
How about you?
He shrugged. I don't know. He'd spent the last couple of hours reading the police file on the Yahoo who signed himself Yeoman. Now he wasn't sure what to think. The M.O. is all wrong. Our friend likes to litter the landscape with corpses, but most of them have arrows sticking out of sensitive parts of their anatomy.
I remember the papers used to call him the bow and arrow killer, too, Jupe said.
Jay nodded. Not that he isn't flexible. If he can't put a razor-tipped broadhead through your eye, he'll strangle you with a bowstring or use an arrow with an explosive tip to blow you to hell. The cops have him down for one job with a knife and two with bare hands, but those have question marks next to them. Mostly he goes in for theme murders. He's got a real grudge against Orientals, too, judging from the number he's offed. But he's not fussy. He'll kill anyone in a pinch, Jay sighed. The only problem is Chrysalis was beaten to death by someone who was inhumanly strong. And our friend with the playing card fetish is a gnat.
How can you be sure? Jupe asked.
I took a crack at archery once, Jay said. It's hard. You'd need to work on it for years to get good. And this psycho is a lot better than good. Why bother if you're an ace? Jupe plucked thoughtfully at one of his tusks.
Yeah, he said. Only,
the fat little joker hesitated. What? Jay prompted.
Well, Jupe said reluctantly, I think maybe Chrysalis was frightened of the guy.
Tell me, Jay said.
The last Ace of Spades murder was something like a year ago, Jupe said. Then they just stopped. It was about the same time the Chrysalis changed. I'm sure of it.
Changed how? Jay asked.
It's hard to explain. She tried to act the same, but if you saw her every night like I did, you could see she wasn't. She was too interested, if you know what I mean. Before, when you came to her with some information to sell, she always acted a little bored, like she didn't care one way or the other. But this last year, it was like she didn't want to miss any little piece of information, no matter how trivial. And she was especially desperate for any kind of word on Yeoman. She offered to pay extra.
Shit, Jay said. This put him back at square one.
You couldn't exactly tell if she was frightened. Not with Chrysalis, Jupe said. You know how she was. She always had to be in control. But Digger was jumpy enough for both of them.
Digger? Jay asked.
Thomas Downs, Jupe said. That reporter from Aces Magazine. Everyone calls him Digger. He's been hanging around the Crystal Palace ever since he and Chrysalis came back from that round-the-world tour last year. 2-3 nights a week, he'd come in, she'd see him, and they'd go upstairs.
Was he getting any? Jay asked.
He stayed past closing all the time, Jupe said. Maybe Elmore Sasha could tell you if he was still there in the morning.
He scratched at one of the stiff red bristles on the side of his head.
Elmo, anyway.
That comment struck Jay as odd. Why not Sasha? He's a telepath. He'd know who she was fucking, if anyone would.
Sasha wasn't spending as much time around the palace as he used to. He's been seeing this woman, a Haitian, I hear, lives down by the East River. Word is she's some kind of hooker. One of the roomers here, Reginald, works night security at a warehouse near there. He says Sasha comes and goes a lot. Sometimes he doesn't leave until dawn.
Not good, Jay said. He was starting to get an inkling of why Chrysalis thought she needed a bodyguard. Sasha had never been a major league telepath, only a skimmer plucking random thoughts off the surface of a mind. But for years his abilities had sufficed to give Chrysalis early warning of any approaching trouble. But if Sasha had been spending a lot of nights out...
There's something else, Jupe said,
thick blue-black fingers, worried at a tusk again.
About 10-11 months ago, Chrysalis had a whole new security system installed. Cost a fortune. All state-of-the-art stuff. I know a man who works for the company that did the work. According to what I heard, Chrysalis wanted them to design, now get this, some kind of defense to kill anybody who tried to walk through her walls.
Jay picked up the glass. The ice cube had melted. He didn't like the taste of rum anyway. He drained the glass in one long swallow, feeling more and more angry with himself. Yeoman had come in through the front door that night at the Crystal Palace. None of them heard him enter. But when they looked up, he was there. But his girlfriend, the sexy little blonde bimbo in the black string bikini, she came in through a wall, stepping out of the mirror behind the bar, and ducking out the same way after Jay sent Yeoman off to play in traffic.
What's wrong? Jube asked.
Nothing but my goddamned instincts, Jay said bitterly. Did they build her the trap she wanted?
They told her there was no such thing, Jube replied.
Pity, Jay said. Pity.
The Church of Our Lady of Perpetual Misery was nearly empty. A few scattered penitents were kneeling on the scarred wooden pews, head or heads, bowed in silent prayer to the God who was more real to them than the clean-featured Jesus of the old Bible. The hunchback called Quasiman was puttering about the altar, humming to himself as he dusted the tabernacle. Dressed in a sharply pressed lumberjack shirt and clean jeans, he moved in a stiff, jerky manner, dragging his left leg behind him. The wildcard virus had twisted his body, but had also given him extraordinary physical strength and the ability to teleport. He put the tabernacle down and watched Brennan as he approached the altar.
Hello, Brennan said. I'm here to see Father Squid.
Hello.
Quasiman's eyes were dark and soulful, his voice soft and deep.
He's in the chancellery.
Thanks, Brennan began to say, but stopped when he realized that Quasiman was staring at him with unfocused eyes. The Joker's jaw was slack and a line of spittle drooled down his chin. It was obvious that his mind was wandering. Brennan simply nodded to him and went through the door at which he still pointed.
Father Squid was sitting behind his battered wooden desk, reading a book. He looked up and smiled when Brennan knocked on the open door. At least he looked as though he smiled.
Father Squid was an immense, squat man in a plain cassock that covered his massive torso like a tent. His skin was gray, thick, and hairless. His eyes were large and bright and gleamed wetly behind their nictitating membranes. His mouth was masked by a fall of short tentacles that dangled like a constantly twitching mustache. His hands, closing the book and setting it on the desk before him, were large with long, slim, attenuated fingers. Rows of circular pads, vestigial suckers, lined his palm. He smelled faintly, not unpleasantly, of the sea.
Come in. Sit down.
He regarded Brennan with the benign affection with which he usually faced the world.
Here I am reading the words of an old friend.
He gestured at the book. A Year in One Man's Life, the Journal of Xavier Desmond.
And another old friend appears, though,
he wiggled his long fingers in reproach,
it would have been nice if you had dropped by to see me before you vanished. I was somewhat worried about you.
Brennan smiled with little humor. Sorry, Father. I told Tacky on my plans, trusting he'd pass the word to those who cared. I hadn't figured on ever returning to the city, but recent events have made me change my mind. Father Squid looked troubled.
I can guess. The death of Chrysalis. I knew that you two were close at one time. The police say I killed her.
Yes, I'd heard.
And not believed?
Father Squid shook his head. No, my son. You would never have killed Chrysalis. While I can't say that I approve of some of the things you've done, only he who is without sin should cast the first stone, and I'm afraid that the antics of a far from an unblemished youth have left me unable to claim spiritual purity.
Father Squid sighed.
Chrysalis, poor girl, was a sad soul searching for salvation. I hope that now she has at least found peace.
I hope so too, Brennan said. And I'll find her killer.
The police,
Father Squid began, think I did it. The priest shrugged massive shoulders.
Perhaps. Perhaps for now they are grasping at straws, but will eventually set their feet upon the proper path. I'll not deny you my help if you are determined to proceed on your own. If, that is, I know anything of value.
He rubbed the spot where his nasal tentacles gathered.
Although I cannot conceive what I would know that would be useful in tracking her killer.
Maybe you can help me find someone who does know something.
Who?
Sasha. He does belong to your church, doesn't he?
Sasha Starfin is a faithful churchgoer, the priest said. Though, upon thinking about it, it has been quite a while since he's partaken of communion.
He's disappeared, Brennan said, more concerned with tracking down Sasha's body than with the state of his soul. You know that he lived at the palace. I think he's gone into hiding because he witnessed the murder. Father Squid nodded.
That may be. Have you tried his mother's apartment?
No, Brennan said. Where is it?
The Russian section of Brighton Beach,
Father Squid said, giving specifics. Thanks. You've been a big help. Brennan rose to leave, then hesitated and turned back to the priest. One last thing. Do you know where Quasiman was early this morning? Father Squid looked solemnly at Brennan.
Surely you don't suspect him. He has the gentlest of souls.
And very strong hands. Father Squid nodded.
That is true, but you can take his name off your list of suspects. As you may know, it has become something of a gnat fad to acquire joker remains. Bodies, skeletons, what have you, as conversation pieces. Quasiman was guarding our cemetery last night. At least I hope he was. He forgets things, you know.
I've heard. Was he there all night?
All night.
Alone? Father Squid hesitated a bit.
Well, yes.
Brennan nodded. Thanks again. Father Squid raised his hand in benediction.
God go with you. I shall say a prayer for you, and, he added quietly as Brennan left, for Chrysalis's murderer. With you on his trail, he shall certainly need someone to pray for the repose of his soul.
7 p.m. A small crowd had gathered on the sidewalks outside the Crystal Palace, and four police cruisers were parked out in front, a fifth by the alley in back. As Jay climbed out of the cab, he recognized Mazarek standing beside one of the cop cars, talking on the police radio. The building was sealed off. The steps up to the main entrance had been blocked with sawhorses, and a yellow crime scene banner was draped across the door. There were lights in the third floor windows. He figured they were giving her private rooms a real good hard look. A couple of uniforms prowled through the rubble-strewn lot next door, shining flashlights into holes, looking for God knows what. The gawkers watched everything with interest, muttering to each other all the while. It was the usual Jokertown street crowd, mostly jokers, with a slumming gnat or two standing nervously on the fringe. Hookers cruised the sidewalk across the street, soliciting right under the noses of the cops. Off to one side, four werewolves in gang colors and May West masks were having a fine old time cracking wise to each other. A few Crystal Palace regulars stood looking on. Mazarek hung up the phone. Jay walked over. So, he said. The murderer returned to the scene of the crime yet? You're here, Miss Eric pointed out. Droll, Jay said. Find any prints? Plenty. So far we've got yours, hers, Elmo's, Sasha's, Lupo's, you name it. What we're not finding are the files. Ah, said Jay noncommittally. There's such a thing as knowing too much for your own good. Kant thinks our motive is somewhere in those secret files. Real good, Jay said, watching a very nice rear end in a tight leather miniskirt sway past. For a lizard. He was turning back to Miseric when he noticed a hooded shape standing in the mouth of an alley half a block away. I'll tell him you said that, Miseric said, with the barest hint of a smile. The thing of it is, Jay said, if Kant finds that cache of information, he may get more than he bargained for. Motives are like fingerprints. Too many are as bad as none at all. He glanced back toward the alley. The hooded man stood in shadow, watching the palace. His head turned, and Jay caught a brief flash of metal as the light reflected off the steel mesh fencing mask beneath the hood. I'm sure he'll be grateful for that hint. Any other words of advice you want me to pass on to him? Yeah, Jay said. Tell him it's not Elmo. He looked back at Miseric again. Sasha at home? He's rooming with his mother until we're done going over the building. Not that it's any business of yours. Didn't Ellis tell you to stay the hell away from this? I'm staying away, Jay said. He caught a hint of motion out of the corner of his eye and glanced aside just in time to see the hooded man melt back into the shadows of the alley. All the good clues are inside, he continued, without missing a beat. You see me going inside? Jay held up his hands, palms out. But hey, I'm easy. In fact, I'm going. See? Bye now. Miseric frowned at him as he backed off, then shrugged, turned, and went back inside the Crystal Palace. When he was gone, Jay spun and elbowed his way through the crowd to the alley. It was too late. The man in the fencing mask and black hood was gone. Except man wasn't quite right. Under that dusky black cloth, the talk on the street said the massive body of the oddity was male and female both. But whatever else the Joker was, one thing was certain. It was strong.
8 p.m. A little old woman, tiny as an ancient sparrow, opened the door a crack when Brennan knocked. Is Sasha in? Brennan asked.
No.
Brennan put his foot in the door, holding it open as she pushed to close it. He had seen a flash of movement in the room beyond the door, and he knew who it was. Sasha, I don't want to hurt you, he called out. I just want to talk. The old woman struggled to close the door, pushing valiantly but uselessly against Brennan's weight. Then a weary voice called out, It's all right, Ma. Let him in. There was a long sigh, then Sasha added, I couldn't hide from him for a very long anyway. Sasha's mother backed away from the door and let him enter. She had a worried expression on her wrinkled face as she glanced from Sasha, who collapsed on the living room sofa, back to Brennan. It's all right, Ma. Why don't you go brew some tea? She nodded and bustled off to the kitchen as Brennan looked at Sasha with concern. The bartender had always been thin, but now he was no more than muscle and bone. He looked deathly tired, and his face was lined and pale. What's going on? Brennan asked. Not a damn thing. Sasha shook his head tiredly. There was pain and loss in his voice, and an unconcealed bitterness that Brennan had never heard before. Why are you hiding out? Did you recognize Chrysalis's murderer telepathically? Sasha just sat there. For a while, Brennan thought he wouldn't say anything, but then he nodded.
I heard someone, he finally said.
Who?
A PI. That Popinjay character.
Jay Aykroyd, Brennan thought. He'd had a run-in with the ace before, but he couldn't conceive of him as a murderer. What was he doing at the palace?
Sasha said nothing. Just shrugged.
What about Elmo? Brennan asked.
The bartender shook his head. Chit sent him out late the night before on some kind of secret errand. Didn't tell me anything about it.
The bitterness came back, this time edged with fear.
He never got back to the palace. I heard that the cops are looking for him.
You think he did it?
Sasha laughed.
Maybe. What a joke. Do you think the dwarf would ever hurt her? He loved her. It's almost as funny as thinking you killed her.
You don't know anything more. Nothing specific about the murder.
Sasha fidgeted nervously and picked at an ugly scab on the side of his neck.
How about who did it?
He asked in a frantic burst of words.
I was getting a drink of Freakers this afternoon, and everyone was talking about it.
About what?
About Bludgeon. He did it. He killed Chrysalis. He'd been bragging about it.
Why would Bludgeon kill Chrysalis?
Sasha shrugged.
Who knows why he does anything? He's crazy mean. But I heard he's trying to get back with the fists. I guess he's had a hard time since the Mafia got busted up.
Brennan nodded grimly. It made sense.
Bludgeon was nothing but muscle. He was strong but stupid, and he'd proven to be even too brutal for the Shadow Fists, who cut him loose a couple of years ago. He'd hooked on with the Mafia, but the Mafia had been crushed in a vicious gang war with the Fists last year. If Kian and the Fists had put a contract on Chrysalis, Bludgeon was certainly capable of beating her to death to ingratiate himself with them. Sasha's mother returned from the kitchen with a tea tray. Brennan watched as Sasha lifted a steaming cup with shaking hands.
I have to go, he said. Take care of yourself, Sasha. He nodded to the old woman as he left her apartment. If the rumor was around town as Sasha said it was, Tripod would pick up on it and find Bludgeon. At any rate, Bludgeon was only the muscle. He may have done the killing, and if he did, Brennan wanted him, but he wanted the one who'd sicked him on Chrysalis even more. He had a truce with Kian. He had called off his vendetta against his old enemy, but if Kian or anyone in Kian's organization had ordered Chrysalis's death, the Fists were going to bleed.
9 p.m. The apartment was aloft over a bankrupt print shop, in a century-old cast-iron building a block off the river. Over the door, a sign faded to almost illegibility, said Blackwell Printing Company. Jay peered through the window pane, but the grime covered it like a coat of gray paint, and he could get no hint of the interior. He shoved his hands into the pockets of his blazer and walked slowly up and down the sidewalk. As far as he could see, there were two ways into the loft. An old iron fire escape clung to the back side of the structure. He could probably pull the ladder down and climb in through a window. Or he could just ring the bell. He could see lights in the loft windows. To hell with it, he thought. He went around to the steel-reinforced door by the alley. There was no name on the bell. Jay jabbed it with his thumb. After a moment, there was a metallic rasping noise, and the lock on the steel door disengaged. That was easy, Jay thought as he pushed his way inside. He found himself at the bottom of a narrow flight of stairs in a ghastly little hallway that smelled of mold and printer's ink. A light bulb dangled from the ceiling, swaying slightly from side to side as moths fluttered around it. The bulb was hot and bright, probably way too high a voltage for the old wiring in this fire trap, but it did light up the place. One of the moths brushed against it and fell, smoking at his feet. Its burned wings beat a frantic tattoo against the barewood floor. Jay stepped on it and felt it crunch as he ground it into the floor with his heel. He wondered what the hell Sasha saw in a place like this. A door opened on the landing above him.
Aren't you coming up?
A woman's voice called down. Jay had no idea whom she was expecting, but he didn't figure it was him. I'm looking for Sasha, he said as he started up the steps. They were so cramped and steep it was hard going. Sasha is not here. The woman came out of the loft and stood on the top step, smiling down at him. I am all alone. Jay looked up. He stopped right where he was. He stared. The woman ran the tip of her tongue across full pouty lips. She was dressed in a short red teddy that barely reached her hips. No panties. Her pubic hair was black and thick. And when she stood with her legs apart like that,
He could see a lot more than just hair. Her skin was a light brown color, the kind Hiram would call café au lait. A tangle of wild black hair fell across her shoulders and back, longer than her teddy. Under the wisp of fabric was the most magnificent pair of tits that Jay Aykroyd had ever seen. "Come on," she said to him. Her accent was as provocative as the rest of her. "Come on," she repeated, with more insistence. Jay resisted the urge to look over his shoulder to see if somebody else was on the steps behind him. He couldn't take his eyes off her anyway. When Jube had said that Sasha was seeing a Haitian prostitute, he'd expected some gaunt, pockmarked girl with hungry eyes and needle tracks along her arms. He cleared his throat and tried to sound like he ran into half-naked women all the time. He managed. Sasha bores me, the woman said. I am Azili, come. She smiled again and held out her hand. I'm Jay Aykroyd, Jay said. I'm a friend of Chrysalis, he added. Sasha, too, he went on. I need to talk to him again, he explained, about her. He clarified, Chrysalis, that is. All the time walking up the stairs, Azili just listened, nodding, smiling, nodding. Jay was two steps below her when he saw that her eyes matched her lingerie. Two small black irises surrounded by a sea of liquid red. Your eyes, Jay blurted out, stopping suddenly. Azili reached down, took his hand, and put it between her legs. Her heat was like a living thing. Moisture ran over his fingers and down the inside of her coffee-colored thighs. She moved against him and gasped as his fingers slipped up inside her, moving almost of their own accord. She had her first climax right there on the stairs, grinding her hips furiously against his hand. Afterward, she licked his fingers like a greedy child, sucking the fluids off them one by one, then drew him wordlessly into the apartment. By then, Jay had forgotten all about her eyes.
10 p.m. There was never a werewolf around when you needed one. Egrets were scarce, too. Brennan pounded the streets for 2 hours before he spotted one of the gang members, a werewolf, staggering out of Freakers. The werewolf was big, hairy, and muscular. He wore faded and torn jeans and enough chains and leather straps and cords to fill Michael Jackson's closet. The plastic May West mask that covered his face added more than a touch of incongruity to his appearance. He stopped on the street in front of Freakers to extort a few bucks from some slumming gnat tourists who were trying to decide whether or not to go into the bar, then lurched past them into an alley half a block down the street. Brennan followed him. The alley was suitably dark and isolated. The Joker was urinating against a brick wall and singing, I'm so lonesome I could die, to himself, lowly and badly. He was zipping up his fly when Brennan laid the edge of his knife against his throat and said conversationally, I think your voice would sound a lot better if I cut you right here. What do you think? The Joker stood paralyzed until Brennan stepped back. Then he turned around slowly, carefully holding his hands out and away from his sides.
You some kind of crazy gnat?
The Joker finally asked. Just visiting in the big bad city to check on some of my old friends. Brennan reached into the pocket of his denim jacket with his left hand. My card, he said, holding up an ace of spades. The huge Joker seemed to shrink back into himself.
You're the real thing, man.
Try me, Brennan offered. But the Joker just shook his head. I don't want to dance, Brennan said. I just want to talk. I'm looking for one of the bigger fish. Warlock, Lazy Dragon, maybe Fade Out. Seen any of them tonight?
I seen Dragon earlier. He said he was going to be spending the night at Chickadee's, but he wasn't too happy about it. He was bodyguarding some fist wheel, so he couldn't party.
Brennan nodded. Lazy Dragon was a freelance ace who worked part-time for the fists. Often directly for a Shadow Fist lieutenant named Philip Cunningham, who was fairly high in the organization. Cunningham, who was also called Fade Out because of his ability to turn invisible, would know if Kian had put out a contract on Chrysalis.
Brennan had once worked for Fade Out himself, when he joined the Fist undercover in an attempt to bring them down from within. In fact, he'd saved Fade Out's life when the Mafia had attacked his headquarters. Perhaps they could come to some kind of accommodation.
Okay,
Brennan said. He gestured with his knife.
That the model the werewolves are wearing this week?
Huh? Your mask.
Sure.
Give it to me. Brennan watched the werewolf carefully. The common mask the gang wore was their symbol, their badge of belonging. Some fanatic werewolves would kill before giving it up. This one visibly tensed, then sighed and relaxed. He obviously knew Brennan's reputation, and despite his size and ferocious appearance, had no wish to tangle with a man who had decimated Shadowfist ranks the year before. He slipped the mask off and gave it to Brennan, turning his face down and away. Brennan took the mask, glanced at the man's face, and said nothing. He'd seen worse, a lot worse. Though he could understand why the fierce-looking werewolf was ashamed of his face. It looked as if it had stopped growing during the man's first year. It was a baby's face, soft and beautiful, perched grotesquely in the middle of his oversized head. It contrasted weirdly with the Joker's savage metal and leather appearance. Brennan stepped back, and the werewolf edged around him and backed away, face still averted. He started off down the alley.
"Your fly's still undone," Brennan called out after him.
"Sleep," Azili whispered to him afterward. He was very drowsy. He felt as though he could just surrender, settle slowly into the deep, soft pile of the carpet beneath him. Close his eyes and drift peacefully. Until this moment, he hadn't realized how exhausted he was. Azili was smiling down at him, the soft weight of her breast against his arm. They'd never even bothered to turn on a light, but he could see her dimly by the light from the street lamp outside, filtering through softly blowing curtains. Her nipples were large and dark, the color of bittersweet chocolate. He remembered the taste of them. He reached out his hand, stroked the soft skin on the underside of her breast, but this time her fingers caught his wrist and gently took his hand away. "No," she whispered. "Just sleep. Close your eyes, little boy. Dream." She kissed his brow. "Dream of Azili Jarouge." Some part of Jay realized how crazy this was, but the rest of him didn't care. He wondered if Azili was going to try and hit him up for money. She was supposed to be a hooker, after all. He didn't care. Whatever she charged, she was worth it. "How much for all night?" he whispered drowsily. Azili seemed to find that amusing. She laughed a light musical laugh and began to stroke his forehead with languid, knowing fingers. It was incredibly soothing. The room was warm and dark. He closed his eyes and let the world begin to drift away. Azili's fingers touched and gentled. Far off, he heard her talking to herself, murmuring, "All night, all night," as if it were the funniest thing anyone had ever said. There were other noises, too, more distant, a door opening somewhere, a rustling of clothing, as if there were someone else there with them. But Jay was too tired to care. He was floating, sinking into a warm sea of sleep. And tonight, he knew his nightmare would not come. Then the outer door slammed open with a loud bang, and someone screamed, "Where is he?" Bright light from the hallway fell across Jay's face, jolting him awake. He sat up groggily and put a hand in front of his eyes. Through his fingers, he saw a man outlined in the doorway, indistinct against the glare. "Shit," he complained, before he quite remembered where he was. Azili was on her feet, screaming at the intruder in French. Jay didn't speak a word of French, but he could tell from her tone that you wouldn't find many of those words in your basic French-English dictionaries. He heard a muffled noise behind him and turned just in time to glimpse a dark shape vanish through a bedroom door. A child, he thought, with some kind of humpback or twisted spine. But in the dim light,
It was hard to be sure. Whoever it was slammed the door behind them.
I couldn't help it,
the man in the doorway said. His voice was hoarse and shaky. Azili spat more venom at him in French.
I didn't know, he pleaded. Please, I can't wait, Azili. I need the kiss. I need it bad. Listen to me.
Jay knew that voice. He got to his knees, bumped into the edge of the couch, fumbled for a lamp, and turned on some light.
You don't understand what I've been through,
Sasha said. Shut up, fool, Azili said in English. You have a visitor. Sasha's head turned slowly until it faced Jay.
You!
Jay suddenly remembered that he was naked. His clothes were scattered all over the room, pants over the back of the couch, boxer shorts dangling from the lampshade. Socks and shoes, God knows where. Azili was just as naked. Of course, Sasha had no eyes, somehow. Jay didn't think it mattered. Me, Jay admitted, a little sheepishly. He snatched his boxer shorts off the lamp, climbed into them, and tried to think what else to say. Pardon me, Sasha, I came here to talk to you, but I wound up fucking your girl on the living room carpet. And by the way, she is one terrific piece of ass. No, he couldn't say that. Of course, he just thought that, and Sasha was a telepath, which meant that he already... Coward, Azili snarled at Sasha. Weakling, why should you have the kiss? You don't deserve it. Jay looked at her a little shocked. This was a whole different side of Azili, and she sure as hell didn't sound like a hooker talking to a well-heeled customer. She stood with her fists balled on her hips, naked and furious, and Jay noticed for the first time that she had a big crusty brown scab on the side of her neck. He thought of various venereal diseases, then of AIDS, remembered that she was supposed to be Haitian, and felt like a total idiot. Where the fuck is my shirt? He said angrily, louder than he'd intended. Azili and Sasha both looked at him. Azili muttered something in French, spun on a bare foot, and stalked off toward the bedroom. She slammed the door behind her. Jay heard it lock. Sasha looked as though he was going to cry, although Jay wasn't at all sure you could cry without eyes. He sagged into an armchair and lifted his head to favor Jay with his eyeless stare. Well, Sasha said bitterly, what do you want? Jay, struggling into his pants, felt at a certain disadvantage, but he tried not to let on. I'm looking for Elmo, he said, zipping up his fly. Everyone's looking for Elmo, Sasha complained. He looked like shit, Jay thought, except that he'd never seen shit look as pale and sweaty and trembly as Sasha looked right now. Well, I don't know where he is. He went off to run an errand, and he didn't come back. Sasha giggled. It was a thin, high, frightening sound, on the edge of hysteria. The dwarf who never returned. That's Elmo. Good for him. They'll hang him for it, you know. Wait and see. He's only a joker. Jay couldn't find one of his socks. He shoved the other one in a pocket and sat on the edge of the couch to lace up his shoes. The couch was new, expensive, upholstered in plush wine-colored velvet. Jay gave the apartment a good once-over, really seeing it for the first time. The floors were covered by deep-pile wall-to-wall carpeting, as white as snow. On the far side of the pass-through was a modern kitchen, where rows of copper-bottomed pots hung between a towering bronze refrigerator freezer and a microwave that could double as a hangar for small planes. The living room was full of weird but expensive-looking primitive art that Jay figured must be Haitian. Elaborate painted symbols covered the walls. Off to his left, the loft had been subdivided into a maze of smaller rooms. It looked like there could be 5 or 6 bedrooms back there. What is this place? Jay said, a little baffled. It's a place you don't belong, Sasha said. Why don't you just leave me alone? I will, as soon as you've answered a few questions. That made Sasha furious. No, he shouted. Now I told you, I can't wait, damn it. You get out of here. I need the kiss. I don't want you here. I don't want you bothering me. Jay had never seen Sasha this way. What the hell is wrong with you? He asked.
Sasha, are you hooked on something?
Sasha's rage suddenly changed to giggles again.
Oh, yes, he said. Kisses. Oh, kisses sweeter than wine.
Jay stood up, frowning. Kisses, he repeated sourly. Azeelee was real good in bed, but if this is what a long-term relationship with her did to you, he'd settle for a one-night stand.
Sasha, I don't give a damn about your love life. I just need to find Elmo. He knows me well enough to know I won't turn him in. I just want to talk. He might know something that could help me figure out who killed Chrysalis.
Sasha stroked his little pencil-thin mustache in a motion that was almost furtive.
But we know who killed her, don't we? He left his calling card, didn't he?
Yes. I see you remember.
I can see the picture in your head right now.
It made Jay feel a little creepy to have Sasha fooling around in his mind. Someone dropped an ace of spades on the body, he said. But I'm not convinced it was Yeoman.
It was him,
Sasha interrupted. He surged to his feet angrily.
Yeoman! That's who it was! There's your murderer, Popinjay! Oh, yes! He's back in town! I just saw him!
Jay was unsure. You saw him? Sasha nodded rapidly.
Out at Brighton Beach, my mother's place. He came looking for me. He's after Elmo, too.
Why? Jay demanded. Why would he kill Chrysalis? Sasha looked around the room, as if to make sure that no one else was listening, then leaned forward and whispered.
She knew his real name,
he giggled.
Would you like to hear it? If I tell you, will you go away and leave me alone?
You know it, too? Sasha nodded eagerly.
She never said it aloud, but sometimes she thought it. I picked it right out of her mind one day. If Yeoman knew, he'd kill me, too. Do you want it?
Tell me, Jay said.
You promise you'll go away? You won't bother me anymore? You won't pry into my affairs?
I promise, Jay said impatiently.
Daniel Brennan,
Sasha said.
Now get out.
Jay looked back once on the way out as he pulled the door of the apartment shut behind him. Sasha was kneeling by the bedroom door, eyeless face pressed up against the wood, pleading for a kiss.
11 p.m. Chickadees was located in the heart of the Bowery. Its exterior was plain, almost severe, graystone, with no sign, canopy, or doorman to announce its existence. Chickadees didn't have to advertise. Word of mouth was enough. Brennan went up the steps empty-handed, having stashed his bowcase in a rental locker. I was met in the bordello's anteroom by a joker with the approximate size and musculature of a male gorilla. The joker gave him the once-over and sniffed, a little put off by Brennan's jeans and T-shirt. Nevertheless, he opened the antechamber's inner door, leading, as Chickadee's thousands of satisfied customers thought, to paradise. 12-fingered Jake was playing the piano in the corner of the greeting parlor, pounding out the complicated chords of the super syncopated music he called J-Jazz, Joker Jazz, that took all 12 of his fingers to play properly. Johns, dressed mostly in expensive-looking three-piece suits, was sitting on the parlor's comfortable chairs and sofas, drinking and chatting with the girls. The women of the house ran the gamut of races and colors. All were beautiful, but since this was Joker Town, some of them had decidedly unusual attributes. A nat hostess met Brennan at the door. At least she looked like a gnat, and the garter belt nylons and high heels she wore could have done very little to conceal Joker deformities. It was true, though, that some of the girls at Chickadees were different in very subtle ways.
"Hello, Joe," she said. "I'm Laurie. Want a party?"
Brennan smiled. "I'm looking for a man," he began.
"Wrong place, Joe. We got all kinds of girls. White ones, black ones, brown ones, ones like you've never seen before. But if you want a man..."
"A friend, I mean," Brennan added hastily. "Lazy dragon."
"Oh,"
Laurie nodded. She linked arms with Brennan and drew him toward her. Her sleek hip pressed against Brennan's, her long, lean, silk-covered thigh brushed against his as they walked.
"I should have guessed with the mask and all. Marilyn Monroe, right? She's one of my favorites. I'll take you out myself. I can use another taste."
Sure. Brenham followed, somewhat mystified, but satisfied that his minimal disguise was doing its job. They went through the parlor area, raucous with the J-Jazz flowing from 12-finger Jake's nimble digits, and the chatter of 30 girls and 50 prospective Johns, up a flight of stairs, and down a corridor ending in closed double doors guarded by a couple of werewolves wearing Mae West masks identical to Brennan's.
"What's up?"
one of them asked as Brennan and the girl approached. Brennan nodded.
"Relief. Let me check in with Dragon."
"Just one of you? Who gets off?"
Brennan shrugged. "Not my decision." The werewolf grunted, stood aside, and Brennan and Laurie went through the doors. Inside was a large room decorated with the exuberantly lavish taste one might expect in an establishment like Chickadee's. Half the walls were wallpapered in a silver and gold paisley pattern. The other half were mirrored, making the room seem much bigger than it really was. The overstuffed couches and fat hassocks scattered about the room were all occupied by housegirls and men wearing suits that were as tasteful as the wallpaper. A naked girl was lying languorously on one of the couches with lines of what looked like cocaine laid out on her body between and over her ample breasts, up her sleek legs, and converging at the juncture of her thighs. Three men were taking turns snorting lines leading to their favorite body parts. Other girls wearing mostly makeup were circulating with trays with drinks and little silver bowls filled with powders or pills of various sorts. Laurie said,
"See you later, hon,"
and moved off into the drift. Lazy Dragon was sitting in a corner of the room, sipping a drink from a long-stemmed glass. As Brennan watched, he virtuously turned down a bowl of white powder offered him by a sleek black woman whose body was covered by fluffy feathers.
"What do you want?"
Dragon asked as Brennan approached. He was a young man, Asian, small, and trim-looking. He was also a potent ace who could animate, then possess animal figurines he carved or folded out of paper. Right now, he didn't appear to be in a good humor.
"No rest for the wicked, is there?"
Dragon stiffed at the sound of Brennan's voice, half rose, then sank down in his chair.
"What the hell are you doing here, cowboy?"
he said, using the name Brennan had taken when he'd gone undercover and joined the Fists.
Brennan shrugged. "Looks like a fun party. I'd hate to see anything break it up."
He looked steadily at Dragon.
"What's going on, anyway?"
Dragon looked at him for a long time before answering.
"The guy over there,"
he said, indicating a tall, thin, wasted-looking man in white linen trousers, jacket, and shirt.
"It's Quinn, the Eskimo. You've heard of him?"
Brennan nodded. Quinn the Eskimo, his real name was Thomas Quincy, was head of the scientific arm of the Shadow Fists. He specialized in the development of synthetic drugs with extraordinary special effects.
"Trying out a new product?" Brennan asked.
As Brennan watched, Laurie approached Quinn and spoke to him. He smiled and handed her a vial of blue powder, some of which she snorted, some of which she rubbed on her nipples and breasts, turning them the same bright blue color of the powder. Quinn and the men standing around him laughed. At Quinn's urging, one of the men started to lick her breasts. She closed her eyes and leaned up against a nearby wall, and, as the man sucked her nipples, came to an obvious, powerful orgasm.
"What the hell was that?"
Brennan asked. Dragon shrugged.
"The new product. Demonstrating for the distributors. What do you want, anyway?"
Brennan looked back down at Dragon.
"A friend of mine was killed, Dragon. You heard."
"Chrysalis."
Brennan nodded. "And I heard that someone is bragging around town that he did it to get in good with the Fists." Dragon shook his head.
"I didn't know the Fists wanted her dead."
"You don't make policy. I want to talk to someone who does. Fade out."
"He's not happy with you, cowboy. You really fucked us over."
Brennan shrugged.
"That's life," he said. "Fade out will talk to me, or the Fists will bleed."
Dragon stood up slowly, carefully.
"You don't want to start anything here, cowboy. I'm head of security for this party."
Brennan nodded, smiled under his Mae West mask, and backed away.
"And I wouldn't want you to have a black mark on your record. Just tell Fade Out I want to talk."
They stared at each other until Brennan backed out of the room.
"So?"
one of the werewolf guards in the corridor asked Brennan.
"So what?"
"Who's going off duty?"
Oh. Brennan stripped off the Mae West mask and tossed it at the astonished werewolf, who caught it against his chest. I am.
What the hell?
The other one growled angrily.
That's not fair.
Life's a bitch, Brennan told him. Then you die. The werewolves recognized the danger in his voice. They watched him as he went down the corridor, wondering who he was, deciding that it would probably be better if they never found out.
Tuesday, July 19th, 1988. 2 a.m. The stale air trapped inside the unused sewer line the chrysalis had converted into a secret palace entrance stank of mold and rot. It was dark, but for the beam from Brennan's flashlight, quiet, but for the infrequent noises he made as he crept toward the palace. Once he passed a side tunnel the chrysalis hadn't told him about. He thought he heard something moving in it, but decided that now was not the time to indulge idle curiosity. The sewer line led to a tunnel of more recent construction that led, in turn, to a dark basement storeroom. The room was packed with stacks of liquor cases, piles of aluminum beer kegs, and cardboard boxes filled with potato chips, pretzels, pork rinds, and other junk food. Brennan moved through the storeroom silently and went up the flight of stairs to the first floor. He waited for a moment, but neither saw, nor heard, nor smelled anything to indicate that anyone else was in the palace. He hadn't figured there would be. He went down the corridor to Chrysalis's office and paused at the door, strangely reluctant to enter the room. He realized that once he saw her blood splattered on the walls, he would know without a doubt that Chrysalis was dead. She'd kept too much of herself to herself for him to have loved her, but he had shared her bed and some of her secrets. He'd known the lonely woman under the cool exterior. He hadn't loved her, but he could have. He couldn't forget that. It kept gnawing at him like the pain from an open wound, unbound and bleeding. He remembered Chrysalis's office as a dark, quiet, charming room. It had a fabulous oriental carpet on the floor, floor-to-ceiling bookcases full of leather-bound volumes that Chrysalis had actually read, solid oak and leather furniture and dark, purple-patterned Victorian wallpaper. The room had even smelled of Chrysalis, of the exotic frangipani perfume she wore and the amaretto she drank. It had been a peaceful room, and he didn't want to see it transformed into a scene of death and destruction. But he had to. He took a deep breath, pulled away the tape that sealed the door, and entered the office. It was worse than he had suspected. The room had been utterly devastated. Her huge oak desk was on its side halfway across the room from its usual place. Her black leather chair had been shattered. Her bookcases had been torn from the walls and the volumes scattered on the floor. The visitors' chairs had been smashed to kindling. Her wooden file cabinets had been upended and their contents strewn all over the floor and the broken furniture. Worst of all was a light spray of blood, barely visible on the patterned wallpaper, splattered low on the wall behind where her desk and chair normally stood. Brennan had seen a lot of destruction, but this devastation filled him with anger. He took the anger and forced it down, pushing it deep inside himself until it was a glowing pinpoint in the pit of his stomach. This was no time to give in to emotion. Perhaps later he could afford to vent it, but now he needed a cool, dispassionate intellect. Not knowing yet what might constitute an important clue, he memorized the horrible scene in as much detail as he could so he'd be able to reconstruct it in his mind later. Brennan left the office with the room locked in his memory. He couldn't face the stiffness of the tunnels running under the streets. He wanted to breathe fresh, clean air, as fresh and clean anyway as could be found in the city. He went to the stairs that led to the exits of the upper floor and he heard a voice. The last voice he ever expected to hear again, whispering from the dark stairwell ahead of him.
Yeoman, it said, sending shivers up his spine. I'm waiting for you. Come to my room. I'll be waiting, my archer.
It was her voice, Chrysalis speaking in her almost English accent. He stood still for a moment, but heard no one or nothing move in the darkness. Brennan didn't believe in ghosts, but the wild card made nearly anything possible. Maybe Chrysalis hadn't even been killed. Maybe It was all an elaborate hoax, perhaps perpetrated by Chrysalis herself for whatever unfathomable reason. Whatever it was, he couldn't just walk away from it. He drew his Browning high power from his hip holster and crept up the stairs as quietly as a stalking cat. The door to Chrysalis's bedroom was open, and as he peered around the jamb, he could see that someone had been here before him. The intruder had been searching for something and hadn't bothered to be neat about it. Chrysalis's canopied bed had been pulled apart and its mattress shredded. All her Victorian portraits and elegantly framed antique mirrors had been stripped from the walls and lay in silver slivers scattered about the floor. The crystal decanter that usually stood on the nightstand lay shattered on the floor. A fencing mask sat in its place. Brennan entered the room and stared about in dismay. Just as he reached the smashed bed, a bulky figure appeared at the mouth of the walk-in closet where Chrysalis had kept her extensive wardrobe. Its face was feminine and beautiful, but etched with what looked like chronic pain. Her body was grotesque, huge, and blocky under her floor-length black cloak. Something was moving under the cloak. Something twisted and writhed across her chest and abdomen like a sack full of snakes. The intruder stopped short and stared at Brennan, who stared back and pointed his gun. "You're the oddity," Brennan finally said.
"Who are you?"
"No one you know. Call me Yeoman." There was another silence, then the oddity said,
"We see. What are you doing here?"
"That's my question."
"We're looking for something."
Brennan's lips quirked in a grimace. "Let's not draw this out."
"Or what? Shouldn't a threat be in there somewhere?"
Brennan's voice was as cold as glacial ice, the hand holding the gun as steady as a statue's. "I don't threaten. I don't play games. I found you in my friend's bedroom, and I'm inclined to believe you had something to do with her death. If you don't want to tell me anything, fine. I'm not going to turn you over to the police. I'm going to leave you dead."
"We believe you would try,"
the oddity said softly. Brennan said nothing.
"All right," she sighed. "We had nothing to do with Chrysalis's death. When we heard about it, we came looking for something. Some information that Chrysalis was blackmailing us with. We just wanted to recover it before the police found it."
Brennan scowled. "Blackmailing you for money?" The oddity nodded, then her face suddenly screwed up in an expression of intense pain. She gasped and fell to her knees, her arms crossing over her stomach. She threw her head back, her face a rictus of suffering.
"Christ," Brennan murmured.
The oddity wasn't acting. She was in intense, uncontrollable pain. Brennan didn't know what to do or how to help her. He started to approach the helpless joker, but she held out a hand to ward him off. He stared as her features crawled from her face and slid down the side of her throat. Another set of features, swarthy and masculine, began to move around from the back of her head. The new eyes stared at Brennan with suspicion. Even before they were properly in place, even before the oddity finished moaning, he, as Brennan now thought of the Joker, stood, grabbed the leg of the end table that stood near the bed, and threw it at Brennan with a flick of his wrist. Brennan ducked and squeezed off a shot. He never knew if the bullet hit home, because the oddity charged at him like a fullback blasting for the goal line, and when they collided, it felt as if he'd been smashed by a sack full of bricks. He twisted away and placed the powerful sidekick into the squirming mass that was the oddity's torso. A feminine hand grabbed him, and it was much, much stronger than his. It pulled at him, and he followed it without resistance as it whirled him around and slammed him against the wall, hard enough to make his teeth clatter and his back ache. His gun flew away. He hit the floor, rolled, and grabbed a knick-knack stand of solid oak. He swung it with all his strength and caught the oddity in the side. The stand shattered. His arms quivered with shock, and he tried unsuccessfully to shake the numbness from his hands. The oddity hadn't even budged. He swung at Brennan, and Brennan dodged, dodged, and dodged again, dangling his hands at his side, trying to get feeling to return to them. He retreated until he felt a wall against his back, and the oddity loomed before him, scowling with ferocious anger. He swung again, and Brennan ducked, sliding down the wall as the oddity's fist smashed through it, his arm punching into the wall cavity to the shoulder. Brennan slipped around to the side and grabbed one of the posts that had supported the canopy of Chrysalis's demolished bed. He swung it like an oversized baseball bat and connected solidly with the oddity's back right over the kidneys. The oddity howled, more in anger than pain. Brennan swung again, splintering the post into kindling.
"Christ,"
Brennan muttered, as the oddity cursed and wrenched at his trapped arm. There was no sense, Brennan realized, in trying to fight the berserk joker. He dove out of the room as the oddity pulled free and ran down the hallway, gritting his teeth at the pain in his back.
"Well, I'll get you, you bastard!"
the oddity cried. His voice was slurred, as if perhaps two people were fighting for control of it.
"We'll get you!"
Brennan took a deep breath as he ran. No bones were broken, but his whole back felt bruised. There was no time to waste moaning. The police could arrive at any moment to investigate the commotion. He went up the stairs and out through the roof, replaying the oddity's story in his mind. Chrysalis might have extorted favors or information as part of the game she liked to play, but she would never blackmail anyone for money. Brennan knew that wasn't in her. So why was the oddity lying, and what was he, they, whatever, really looking for in the closet of Chrysalis's bedroom?
9 a.m. "You've got a reporter named Thomas Downs," Jay said. The receptionist looked at him dubiously. She was a chic little number who looked like she'd been specially bred to sit behind the high-tech, chrome-and-glassed reception desk. The offices of Aces Magazine were a lot classier than Jay had anticipated. If he'd known they had two entire floors at 666 Fifth Avenue, Jay might have stopped for that shine in the subway. Obviously, there was money to be made in stories about Peregrine's love life.
"Digger didn't come in today,"
the receptionist said. On the wall behind her, the magazine's logo had been burned into a chrome steel plate by Jumpin' Jack Flash. Elsewhere, around the reception area, various distinguished ace visitors had transmuted a chrome ashtray into some kind of weird purple glass, twisted steel bars into new and fanciful shapes, and constructed a perpetual motion machine that had been whirring happily away for 4 years now. Little brass plaques commemorated each of these feats. "Where can I find him?" Jay asked. "It's important."
"I'm sorry," the receptionist said. "We don't give out that kind of information."
"Is there someone else I could talk to?" Jay asked.
"Not without an appointment," she said.
"I'm an ace," Jay told her. She tried to suppress a smile and failed.
"I'm sure you are."
Jay looked around the reception area, made the gun shape with his fingers, and pointed at a long chrome and leather sofa. It vanished with a pop. He'd needed a new couch anyway. "Do I get a little brass plaque?" he asked the receptionist.
"Perhaps Mr. Lowboy could help you," she said, lifting up the phone.
The editorial floor had been partitioned off into a maze of tiny cubicles. Larger private offices with real walls and doors lined the outside of the building, leaving the big central space windowless. There were lots of cheerful colors and potted plants, and peppy music kept the well-dressed staff busy at their computer terminals. Everything was very clean and orderly. Jay hated it. Mr. Lowboy's corner office had no computer terminal, no cheerful colors, and no music. Just a lot of wood and leather, and two huge tinted windows looking out over the Manhattan skyline. Mr. Lowboy wasn't there when they arrived, so Jay wandered around the room, looking at the framed photographs on the walls. He was studying a faded black and white print of Jet Boy shaking hands with a wizened little man who looked like an anemic gnome when Lowboy finally made his entrance.
"That's my grandfather," he said. "He and Jet Boy were like that."
Lowboy crossed his middle and index fingers. He was a couple of inches shorter than Jay and wore a three-piece white suit with a pastel shirt and a black knit tie.
"Why is he handing Jet Boy a check?" Jay asked.
"Ah, well, truth is, he was lending the kid money all the time. Jet Boy never did know how to manage his finances, just like a lot of these modern aces." He held out his hand. "I'm Bob Lowboy. I understand you're looking for Digger." He didn't wait for an answer. "I'm afraid we can't help you," he said as they shook. "Digger's a crackerjack reporter, no doubt of it. but he's not the most reliable man we've got on staff. He took off yesterday during his coffee break, and we haven't seen him since. Aren't you a little concerned about that? Not to worry, Lowboy assured him. He's done it before. The last time, he showed up a week later, with all the dope on the Howler's secret love child. Made the cover. I'll just bet it did, Jay said. If you'd like to leave a card with my assistant, we'll make sure Digger gets it, Lowboy promised. Jay left a card with Mr. Lowboy's assistant and told her he'd find his own way out. He was threading his way through the labyrinth when a woman called out to him. Mr. Aykroyd? She was young, early 20s maybe, dressed in a plain white shirt open at the collar, jeans, and a pinstripe gray vest. Her hair was cropped short, and round wire rims framed her face. Mandy told everyone about the couch, she said. You're Poppin' Jay. She offered her hand shyly. Her nails were trimmed down to the quick. I hate that name. She looked guilty. Oh, God, that's right. It was in your file. I'm sorry, I forgot. I hope I haven't offended you. I'm Judy Scheffel. Sometimes they call me Crash. Crash? Jay said dubiously. Don't ask. I'm Digger's research assistant. Can we talk? She produced a key from the pocket of her vest. The key to Digger's office, she said. Come on. Downs might have been only a reporter, but clearly, Aces valued his services. His office was a third the size of Lowboy's, but it was a real office, with walls, a door that locked, and even a single narrow window. The bookshelves along the west wall were jammed far beyond capacity, and looked as though they could come cascading down at any moment. A computer workstation occupied the corner by the window. Next to it was a bulletin board crowded with mugshots of people that Jay didn't recognize. Who are they? He asked. Crash carefully locked the door. Aces who are still up the sleeve, she said. For future reference. You'd be surprised how many times Digger's been the first to break the story on a new ace. No one else comes close. If they haven't gone public yet, how does he know their aces? Jay said, studying the pictures. I think he has a source down at the Jokertown Clinic who tips him off whenever a new ace is diagnosed. Crash shoved some papers aside and sat on the edge of Digger's desk. Digger's in trouble, isn't he? You tell me, Jay said. He's in trouble, she said. He's always been kind of jumpy, but yesterday, he just freaked. Tell me about it, Jay said. He moved a box of Peregrine pinup calendars off the swivel chair and sat down. We were working on a story yesterday morning about the convention, a profile of the ace delegates. Digger had this tiny little Sony Watchman on in the background in case any news broke on the convention floor. When they came on with the newsflash about Chrysalis, he turned white as a sheet. They were close, Jay said. Maybe even lovers. It wasn't just grief, Crash said. It was fear. Digger was terrified. I gotta go, he said. I asked him when he'd be back, but it was like he didn't hear me. He practically ran out of the office. And Mandy, up front at the desk, she told me he didn't even wait for an elevator. He took the stairs down. Jay had to admit that didn't sound like a man going underground for a story. It sounded like a man running for his life. Downs ever do a story on the bow and arrow killer? No. Aces doesn't run a lot of crime stories. He ever mentioned Chrysalis being afraid of someone? She shook her head. Some of his stories must have pissed people off. Was there anyone in particular had it in for him? Peregrine, Crash said quickly. She and Tachyon were both angry with Digger over a story he did during the tour. He just reported what Tachyon told him. Dr. Tachyon was one of maybe six people that Jay was reasonably certain he could beat in an arm wrestling contest. Perry he wasn't so sure about, but both of them were down in Atlanta anyway. You're sure he had no history with Yeoman, he said. When she nodded, he said, how about the oddity? She considered that for a minute. Digger did a story on the oddity years ago when he first came on staff. He showed it to me once
It was very well written. Digger said it would have won a Pulitzer, but Lowboy spiked it, and it never ran. Why? Jay said. Kress looked embarrassed. It was before my time, but I guess it was because the oddity's a joker. Lowboy is always saying that our readership doesn't want to read about jokers. Was the oddity upset that the story never ran? Not as much as Digger was, she said. Jay frowned. You have any idea where Digger might have gone? Kress shook her head. All I know is he's not at home. I phoned him a half a dozen times, but all I ever get is his machine. That just means he's not answering the phone. Could be hiding under his bed for all we know. He could be dead, too, he thought. Lying on the floor in a pool of his own blood, his brains leaking out on the rug. He didn't say it. I better check. Jay looked at her thoughtfully. Before you said something about my file. Sure, she said. We have files on all the aces. Jay put his hand on top of the computer. Can you get at them through this thing? You can tap into our data library from any workstation, if you've got the password, she said. But I could get fired for giving unauthorized access to our files. No problem, Jay said. I'm sure Digger will understand, if he's still alive. Kress looked at him for a moment, then got up and pulled the dust cover off the computer. Jay leaned over her shoulder. She turned on the machine and typed in Digger's password. Knows? Jay asked. Kress shrugged. It's his password, not mine. What file do you want to look at? Chrysalis got killed by someone who was inhumanly strong. Five'll get you 10 that Digger's hiding from the same guy. I want to know who that could be. I can call up a list of all the aces on file with that power, but it's going to be awfully long. Enhanced physical strength is the third most common wildcard power, after telepathy and telekinesis. Do it, Jay urged. Her fingers moved expertly over the computer keyboard. You want just aces or jokers too? I thought aces didn't report on jokers. We don't, but the library draws from all kinds of sources. Scare reports, scientific papers, clippings from the daily press. The research department is very thorough. If it's strong enough to pulp a human skull, I don't care if it's an ace, a joker, or a rutabaga. We don't have the rutabaga data online yet, she said, entering a series of commands. It seemed a god-awful long time before the computer completed its search. 319 cases, Crash read cheerfully from the screen. Not as many as I thought. That's everyone we know of who's ever displayed physical strength beyond the normal human range. Want me to print out the list? 319 suspects might be a little cumbersome, Jay said. Is there some way to narrow it down? Sure, she said. Factor in some other parameters. Some of these people are dead. We could eliminate them. Dead people make lousy suspects, Jay agreed. Kress typed in a command. 302, she said. Not much of an improvement. What if I restrict it to city residents? Jay thought about that for a moment. No, he said reluctantly. Why not, she asked. It would cut the list by 70 or 80 names, at least. The computer's counting aces from all over the country. Detroit Steel, Big Mama in Chicago, Haymaker in Kansas City? You don't think it was one of them? No, Jay admitted. I figure it's more likely our killer is somebody who actually met Chrysalis. It usually works out like that in murder cases. Problem is, there are some out-of-towners who qualify. Billy Ray and Jack Braun for two. It couldn't be Golden Boy, Crash pointed out. He's down in Atlanta. Besides, Digger was always saying what a weenie he was. Obviously, the mere mention of Braun's name reduced him to a state of abject terror, Jay said. He put his hand on her shoulder. She didn't seem to object. Listen, can this thing cross-index several factors at once? He asked. No problem, she said. Real good, he said. I want anyone with a criminal record or a history of mental illness. Hell, give me anyone
who's been arrested for a crime, never mind whether they were convicted. Also, anyone who's ever been linked to Chrysalis or the Crystal Palace. Anyone who lives in Jokertown or near Jokertown. The Lower East Side, Little Italy, Chinatown, the East Village, anywhere down around there. Can you do that? I think so, she said. Jay gave her shoulder a squeeze and watched her work. When it was done, Crash leaned back in the chair, stretched, said, "Here goes nothing," and pressed the enter key. The machine began to hum and search. It's working through the 302 candidates, name by name, taking each suspect and searching the data banks to see if any of our criteria fit, she explained. You gave me 4 parameters: arrests, mental illness, ties to Chrysalis, geography. I programmed it to flag each name with stars to indicate the number of fits. Real good, said Jay, who hadn't thought of that. Jay grabbed the paper as it slid out of the laser printer, still warm to the touch. 19 finalists had survived. Braun, Jack, Golden Boy, 1 star. Crenson, Croyd, the Sleeper, 4 stars. Darlingfoot, John, Devil John, 3 stars. DeMarco, Ernest, Ernie the Lizard, 2 stars. Doe, John, Doughboy, 3 stars. Jones, Mordecai, the Harlem Hammer, 2 stars. Lockwood, William Jr., Snotman, 4 stars. Man, Modular, no alias, 1 star. Morkel, Doug, no alias, 2 stars. Mueller, Howard, Troll, 3 stars. O'Reilly, Rada, Elephant Girl, 1 star. Ray, William, Carnifex, 1 star. Schaefer, Elmo, no alias, 3 stars. Severs, Robert, Bludgeon, 3 stars. Name unknown, Black Shadow, 2 stars. Names unknown, The Oddity, 2 stars. Name unknown, Starshine, 1 star. Name unknown, Quasiman, 3 stars. Name unknown, Worm, 4 stars. How does it look? Crash asked him. Like a start, he said. He showed her the list. Any of these people ever threatened to rearrange Digger's features? She looked over the names carefully. Well, she said, Billy Ray was pretty upset with him once. Digger wrote a piece on the strongest men in the world, and he said that Billy Ray was minor league compared to Golden Boy and the Harlem Hammer. Ray took it the wrong way. She turned off the computer. But he's in Atlanta, too, isn't he? He better be, Jay said. He's Senator Hartman's bodyguard. He folded up the list and slid it into his breast pocket. 2 more things. Digger's address, he smiled, and your phone number. Well, he thought afterward, 1 out of 2 wasn't bad.
Brennan woke to the jangling of the phone that sat on the nightstand beside the hotel room's lumpy, sagging bed. He sat up and winced as pain lanced through his stiff shoulder and sore back, where the oddity had slammed him against the wall.
Hello?
Morning, Mr. Y.
It was Tripod.
I found someone you might want to have a word with. Name's Bludgeon.
You're right, Brennan said grimly. Where are you?
Uncle Chowder's Clambar,
Tripod said. Right. Brennan hung up. He sat for a moment on the edge of the bed. He was still tired and he ached from the beating he'd taken the night before. Worse, he missed Jennifer more than he had ever missed anyone or anything. Perhaps, he thought, he had lost too many friends and lovers down through the years, and he was getting too old and weary to bear the losses anymore. He stood carefully and stretched his sore back and shoulder cautiously. To hell with it, he told himself. He'd never given up before. He wouldn't start now. He needed rest, but there was no time. He needed food, but he could take care of that easily enough. He needed Jennifer above everything, but there was nothing he could do about that. As he dressed, he decided to leave his bow behind. There was no way he could pull it properly the way his shoulder felt. He'd lost his other weapon, his Browning, the night before, during his tussle with the oddity.
Great,
Brennan thought. Just great. He had to face Bludgeon empty-handed. What a way to start the day. Tripod was lounging against a building whose grimy black facade was in desperate need of a sandblasting. A flashing neon sign proclaimed the ground-floor restaurant, Uncle Chowder's Clam Bar, while a mollusk with a top hat and cane and pink neon smile did a fluttering dance on stick-thin legs. A picket fence of rusty iron bars screened off a stairway that led to the basement. The battered sign bolted to the fence had a pointing six-fingered hand painted on it, a sure sign that they were in Jokertown. "Squisher's Basement," Brennan read. "Charming." He turned to Tripod. "You're sure Bludgeon's still in there?"
"I've been watching," the Joker said, "and he ain't come out."
Brennan nodded and pulled out a sheaf of bills from his jeans pocket. He peeled off 2 20s and gave them to Tripod.
"They don't much like gnats and squishers," the Joker said.
Brennan smiled underneath his mask. "Thanks for the warning." He went down the stairs. Squishers was already crowded with Jokers who felt compelled to drink their breakfasts. The stank of infrequently washed bodies, spilled beer, and indifferently sopped vomit. It was dimly lit, but Brennan could see the heads of the patrons swivel to stare at him as he entered. Conversation stopped as he approached and picked up again when he passed by. Tripod had been right. This was strictly a Joker hangout, and it looked as if they liked it that way. The biggest aquarium Brennan had ever seen was set behind the bar over the shelves of liquor bottles. Something floating in the dark and oily water suddenly surged against the glass and poked his head over the side, blowing water from a hole in the top of his skull. He stared at Brennan with cold, unblinking eyes.
"Don't get many of your kind in here," the Joker finally said.
His ghastly face was set in a hairless round head. His fish mouth was filled with rows of pointy teeth.
"Nuts, I mean. You're a nut, right?"
"I have business with one of your customers." Squisher gave him the fisheye.
"What kind of business?"
"It's none of yours." Brennan could hear the Jokers seated along the bar mutter among themselves.
"This is my place," Squisher said. "Whatever happens in it is my business."
He glanced down into the water, reached out a long boneless arm, and caught something. Brennan saw orange scales flash as Squisher dropped a small fish into his mouth, gulped twice and swallowed, then looked back at Brennan. Brennan removed an ace of spades from his hip pocket and held it out toward the Joker. Squisher squinted, then reached out a long, sinuous arm that ended in a collection of twitching tentacles and took the card from Brennan. He brought the pasteboard close to his face, looked from it to Brennan, then silently slid under the water of his aquarium. Brennan turned to face the room where everyone was suddenly very interested in their drinks and spotted Bludgeon sitting alone at a table in a far, dark corner. He recognized the Joker instantly. He'd only seen him once before during a crazy, confused brawl in Times Square almost 2 years ago, but Bludgeon didn't have the kind of face you could easily forget. He was 7 feet of ugly, with a puckered, scarred face and a right hand that was a twisted club of muscle and bone. He was thinner than the first time Brennan had seen him, so thin that his filthy clothes hung loosely on his frame. His skin was blotchy, his hair long and greasy. He sat alone, staring at nothing and mumbling to himself as Brennan approached. The whites of his eyes were a clouded yellow, shot through with scarlet veins. Brennan stared at him, unsure whether to feel pity or disgust.
"What the fuck you want?"
Bludgeon asked after a long moment.
"Talk on the street is that you killed Chrysalis," Brennan said lowly.
A spark of animation kindled in Bludgeon's sick eyes.
"Yeah?"
he rumbled.
"It was me. Why off the cock-sucking bitch. Buy me a drink and I'll tell you all about it."
"First tell me how you killed her."
Bludgeon held up his clubbed right fist.
"I beat the fucking horse brains out with my hand. It's all I ever needed. Never needed a fucking gun. Never needed no goddamn knife. Just my hand."
The twitch of disgust in Brennan's face, the loathing in his eyes, went unnoticed by the drunken Joker.
"Where?" Brennan said softly.
"Where what?"
"Where'd you kill her?"
"In that shithole saloon of hers, man,"
Bludgeon mumbled.
I threw her on the bar and stuck my dick in her and fucked the living shit out of her.
He laughed and a mad light shone in his sick eyes.
Then, just to make sure she was dead, I beat her fucking head in, just to make sure.
You scum,
Brennan said through clenched teeth.
You shit-eating scum. I'd kill you where you sit if I didn't know that you're lying.
Bludgeon blinked, his porcine eyes staring at Brennan without comprehension. He stood up when Brennan's words finally soaked into his clouded brain and screamed a stream of obscenities. He pushed the table at Brennan, but it only scraped slowly across the floor, and Brennan sidestepped it easily. Bludgeon howled and swung his clubbed arm. Brennan avoided the slow-motion punch and grabbed Bludgeon by his wrist and shoulder and threw him against the bar, scattering jokers left and right. Squisher rose agitatedly from the depths of his aquarium as Brennan picked up a chair.
My tank! The joker screamed. Don't break the glass!
Bludgeon, pinned against the bar and breathing hard, looked at Brennan with fear and pain in his eyes. Brennan swung the chair, smashing him across the gut, and Bludgeon gasped like a fish out of water. Brennan swung again, catching Bludgeon on the side and slamming him down across three bar stools. Bludgeon made a feeble attempt to stand, but his slack muscles wouldn't work. He sighed, bubbling the bloody froth on his lips, and made weak swimming motions with his arms. Brennan checked his third blow when he saw that Bludgeon had nothing left in him. He dropped the chair. The tubular metal of his back and legs twisted into an ornate abstract sculpture.
You didn't kill her, Brennan said in a low voice. Why say you did?
I need a fucking job,
Bludgeon panted.
No one will touch me. No one will give me a fucking chance. I just figured fade out or somebody in the fist would give me a chance, you know? Just give me a fucking chance.
You pathetic lying shit, Brennan said in a low voice. He had known it wouldn't be this easy, partly out of frustration, partly because he wanted Chrysalis's killer to know that he was on his trail. He turned to face the room and said, I was Chrysalis's friend, and I'm going to find her killer. Bet on it. He dropped an ace of spades on Bludgeon and stalked out of the bar. Before he got out of the door, one of the bar's bolder patrons was stripping the leather jacket off Bludgeon's back, slapping him in the face when he protested in a sad, tremulous whine.
11 a.m. Digger's apartment was a fifth-floor walk-up on Horatio in the West Village. In the playground across the street, some teenagers were shooting baskets, shirts against skins. Jay stopped to watch for a few minutes. They had a couple girls playing, but they were both on the shirt side. More's the pity. A heavy-set man with a shaved head sat on the stoop of Digger's building, drinking a can of Rheingold. When Jay stepped off the sidewalk, he got up and blocked the door.
You got business here?
The man had 3 inches and 50 pounds on him, not to mention an eagle tattooed on his right bicep and a gold hoop in one ear. I'm looking for Digger Downs, Jay told him.
He ain't home.
I'll check for myself, thanks.
The fuck you will. We had enough freaks coming around for a free look.
Jay didn't like the sound of that.
You had trouble here?
The man crushed a beer can in his fist.
Nothing like the trouble you're gonna have.
He mulled over the idea of popping this asshole down inside an abandoned subway station, but decided to try it the easy way first.
I want to know what happened here, he said.
He took a fold of bills out of his pocket.
So does Mr. Jackson.
I don't know no Mr. Jackson, the man said.
But you lay a 10 spot on me. You can go inside and look.
Wit was a lost art, Jay decided. On the other hand, he just saved 10 bucks, so he shouldn't complain. He unfolded a $10 bill and put it in the man's thick, calloused hand.
Come on, the man said. I ain't got all day.
They went inside. The entryway was small and dark, doorbells mounted beside the mailboxes. While the big man fumbled for a key, Jay found Downs and pressed his button. There was no answer.
You really looking for Digger?
His host said, grunting again as he opened the inner security door.
Like I told you, he ain't here.
They stepped through the door. And he pointed up the staircase.
You want to see the bloodstains? They're up on 4 and 5. I've been humping up and down all day. I'm sick of all them fucking steps. Are you going to tell me what happened here, or should we play 20 questions? Fuck, I thought the whole city knew. The way the cops were crawling all over the place yesterday. You ought to read the post, mister. Double murder. Oh, shit, Jay said, a sinking feeling in the bottom of his stomach. This iced the cake, he supposed, but the frosting was a real ugly flavor. Downs? Nah, it was Mrs. Rosenstein. She's got the apartment across the hall from Digger. And Jonesy, the super. Let me guess, Jay said. They were beaten to death. Fuck no. It had been a long time since Jay Ackroyd had been that surprised. No, he said. Nah. They was cut to pieces, both of them, by some nutcase with a buzzsaw. I was the one that found them. God, you should have seen it. I took off early yesterday. Had this some bitch of a hangover, and when I come home, there's this shit lying right in front of my door. I'm up on 3. Fuck, I almost stepped in it. It was all bloody, like something you'd find in the garbage behind a butcher shop. Some piece of meat nobody wanted, you know? So I nudge it with my foot, and I seen it had an eye in it. Know what it was? He leaned forward and Jay could smell the beer on his breath. Jonesy's face. Not the whole thing, only half of it. Must have fallen down the stairwell. The rest of him was on the 4th floor landing. I don't know how he made it that far. His whole fucking belly was cut open, and his guts were spilling out on that fag Cooper's welcome mat. His hands was all slimy from trying to stuff him back in. But one of them what-you-call-its, intestines, it went all the way up the stairs to the 5th floor. That was where I found Mrs. Rosenstein. Bet you never knew them intestines were so long, right? He shrugged. Well, the cops took the bodies away, but there's still blood all over the goddamn walls. Now that fucking landlord's gonna have to hang some new wallpaper. Bet it takes him 6 months, though. What about Downs, Jay demanded. Fuck if I know. He ain't been home. The cops checked his door, but it was still locked. He's just off doing some write-up for that fucking magazine. He's gonna be pissed when he finds out what he missed. What a laugh. A riot, said Jay, who didn't think Digger would be pissed at all. Hey, you ever been in Newark City jail? Fuck no, the man said with a frown. Oh, good, Jay said. I spent a night there once. It really sucks. He pointed. Air rushed into suddenly empty space with a pop. It sounded almost like a hiccup, and Jay was alone in the hallway. He started up the stairs smiling. That was pointless and petty. And if he kept doing stuff like that, he was going to get himself sued one of these days, but sometimes it just felt so good. He spotted red-brown traces on the 3rd floor landing, and droplets on the wooden banister between 3 and 4, but the serious bloodstains began on the 4th floor. The faded wallpaper showed long dark streaks in 2 places, where the custodian must have staggered against the wall as he tried to flee, maimed and bleeding, holding himself together with his hands. That was pretty bad, but the 5th floor landing was a lot worse. There were dried brown smears where a body, or a piece of a body, had struck the wall. The carpet runner had soaked up so much blood, it looked black in places. The spray had gone everywhere. The walls were spotted by it, as if the hallway had come down with measles. Over his head was a trapdoor to the roof, and even that had caught a few stray droplets. Jay looked around and tried to reconcile what he was seeing with what he had seen yesterday morning in the Crystal Palace. It didn't add up. A buzzsaw, the asshole downstairs had said. It sure as hell looked like it. The West Village chainsaw massacre. No wonder the post had had a field day. By comparison, Chrysalis had hardly bled at all. A few drops on her blouse, a little down low on the walls, but nothing like this. He tried on the theory that was all coincidence, that this little exercise in atrocity had nothing to do with what had happened to Chrysalis. But every gut instinct he had told him that was bullshit.
What the hell was going on here? Disgusted, Jay turned to Digger's door. It was locked, as advertised. He opened the spring lock easily enough, with a credit card. But there was a deadbolt as well. For that, he needed a lockpick, and a good 10 minutes of work. Jay had deft practiced hands, and a real nice set of lockpicks. But this was a good lock. Finally, he heard the tumblers click, and the door pushed open. There was a chain he saw as he stepped through, but it hadn't been used. Neither had the police bar, which meant the apartment had been locked from the outside. Jay took one look around and said, "Oh, shit." The place had been trashed. Thoroughly and savagely trashed. He moved through the cramped little rooms carefully. Things had been thrown, smashed, stepped on. At every turn, he expected to find a body, or what remained of a body. The living room floor was buried in a blizzard of paper. A gigantic old Zenith console television had been reduced to ground glass and kindling, and what might have been an impressive collection of old LPs crunched underfoot as Jay stepped on the pieces. In the bedroom, the bed was in pieces, sheets razored, stuffing torn out of the mattress and scattered, books sliced in half right down their spines. The kitchen was covered with decaying junk food, the riper bits already crawling with roaches. All the cupboards had been shattered, their contents strewn wildly about. A huge old refrigerator lay face down on the linoleum. When Jay bent to examine it, he found a jagged gash in the thick metal of the door. "Jesus Christ," he said. He stood up. Back in the living room, he noticed the bars on the window. He went through the apartment once again to check. There were thick iron bars on every window, even in the white porcelain ruins of the bathroom. The bars looked new, installed within the past year, Jay would be willing to bet. It looked as though Digger had been as security conscious as Chrysalis. Not that it had done him much good. The windows were all locked. Whoever had done this had come in the same way Jay had, through the front door. Unless maybe they'd come in through a wall. Jay looked around for an ace of spades, not really expecting to find one. Yeoman might be a psychopath, but his killings had always been accomplished with a certain cool professional efficiency. This and the butchery out in the hall looked like the work of some rabid animal. Jay could easily imagine the killer foaming at the mouth as he went from room to room destroying. He was making one final methodical sweep through the apartment when he spotted the notebooks on the bedroom floor, jumbled up with the latest celebrity bios, a few reference books, and a wide selection of paperbacks by anonymous, with soft focus covers of women in Victorian undergarments. Not more than one book in five was intact. The corner of one wire-bound notebook was sticking out from under a snowdrift of loose pages, and the plain cardboard cover caught his eye. He dug through the paper and found three more of them, and parts of a fourth. Reporters' notebooks, filled with a hurried, semi-legible scrawl. A long diagonal chunk was missing from one book, but you could still read most of it. Each notebook was dated. Jay sat gingerly on what remained of Digger's mattress and opened the most recent. The last article Digger had worked up was called The Farmer of Park Avenue, about an 8-year-old girl whose miniature farm filled an entire floor in her daddy's Park Avenue townhome. The farm had model houses, painted rivers, felt grass, toy cars and trucks, and an electric train that circled the property. Her farm animals were real. Cows 4 inches long, tiny little sheepdogs, suckling pigs, the size of cockroaches, all shrunken to their present diminutive size by the freckle-faced little farmer, who just loved animals. Somehow Jay didn't think 8-year-old Jessica von der Staat was a likely suspect. He flipped back to older material, looking for any mention of Chrysalis, death threats, or homicidal maniacs with or without buzzsaws. He found the address of a photographer who had gotten some spicy shots of Peregrine breastfeeding, bios of the government aces assigned to protect the presidential candidates, Hiram's recipe for chocolate mango pie, quotes for a cover profile of Mr. Magnet, and Mistral's fond reminiscences of the day her daddy had taught her to fly. Jay flipped the notebook aside in disgust and found himself possessed of an overpowering urge to get the hell out of this place.
Brennan sat in a booth in Harry's kitchen, sipping occasionally from his cup of tea and ignoring the irritated stares from the passing waitress when he refused to order anything else. He was surrounded by a litter of newspapers that he'd read looking for news about the killing. Chrysalis's death was already relegated to the back pages, pushed aside by the political craziness in Atlanta, where a huge platform fight on the Joker's rights plank was brewing. Barnett was marshalling his holier-than-thou forces, and the big clash between him and Hartman was looming on the near horizon. Chrysalis's death was already old news. Only the Jokertown Cry was still running the killing as a front-page item, including a photo of the detective team heading the investigation, Jokertown's own Harvey Kent and his partner, Thomas J. Mazarek. Brennan put his teacup down, oblivious to another hard stare from the waitress, and looked closely at the grainy newspaper photo of two men standing outside the Crystal Palace. Kent was the Joker on the left, a tall, scaly reptiloid. He reminded Brennan of his old Shadow Fist foe, Worm. The other was Mazarek. Brennan nodded to himself. He slid out of the booth, went to the public phone booth in the back of the restaurant, and dialed the Jokertown precinct. It took a moment for the connection to go through, and then he heard a deep, gruff, tired voice on the other end.
Mazarek.
It was definitely him. Brennan hadn't heard the voice in almost 15 years, but he still recognized it. There was a shadow in it, a brooding, sepulchral tone that hinted at the blackness that had followed Mazarek everywhere when Brennan had known him in Nam.
Long time no see, Brennan said quietly. There was a short silence.
Brennan could almost hear the gears whirring Mazarek's head.
Who is this?
Brennan. Daniel Brennan.
Brennan?
It's me.
Christ. I guess it's been a long time. So is this a social call to renew old acquaintances?
No type, Brennan said. I'd like to talk to you.
About what? After all these years?
About Chrysalis's murder.
What's your interest in that?
Personal. She was a friend of mine.
You always did take things personal. Okay. Where should we have this chat?
Brennan thought it over. He wanted to pump Mazarek for information, but Mazarek was always a close-mouthed sort. It wouldn't hurt to meet in a place that might smooth Mazarek's often touchy feelings, a place Mazarek would also be disinclined to bust up if their talk went sour. How about lunch at Aces High?
That's a little rich for a cop's pay.
My treat.
How can I resist?
1 p.m. More coffee, Jay? Flo asked him. Please, Jay said, pushing the cup across the Formica counter. It was his fourth cup. Flo had removed the evidence of his patty melt and fries 20 minutes ago. Working a puzzle? The waitress asked as she refilled his cup. Some of the coffee slopped over into the saucer. Something like that, Jay admitted. The list was spread out on the counter. He'd been going over it name by name while he ate. A translucent smudge on the paper marked the spot where a bit of onion had slid out of his patty melt. Well, call me if you...